This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Folks, I am Greg Phillips. With me, as always, is Nick Duke. We are the hard-traveling fanboys, and
we haven't been canceled after last week.
No, not well. We haven't been canceled, but I mean, quite frankly, as we sit here in our studios in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, I contemplated not even coming on this week. I mean,
yeah, where do we go? Where do we go?
Follow
there?
Up
the largest podcast ever.
You're just looking for an excuse to do that again, weren't you?
No. I honestly don't know how we follow that up. To me, it was the high point of what we've done, and I don't feel like there's any way to match it. So what? You know, some people are motivated by past success. I'm actually discouraged by past success because I figure, what are the odds of me ever having that kind of success again? Right. So
yeah, it's kind of like after 2008 when you and I both were like, what's the point in ever going to the movies again now that we've seen The Dark Knight? And I would argue that nothing that has come since has been able to match that experience.
What has been the point?
But I digress.
I mean, certainly that's the way to look at it. I mean, when I first read I used to kind of have an inkling that I wanted to be a comic book writer, and I read Watchmen, and I said, well, I give up. But in any event,
well, if it makes you feel any better, I'm sure somebody out there will listen to our podcast from last week and say, you know, I used to want to have a podcast, but not anymore.
Not anymore. There's no point in even trying. Chris Jericho may not even do his biggest podcast ever now. I wouldn't if I were him.
How could Mick Foley, WWE Hall of Famer and legitimate superstar, ever top a breakdown of Watchmen Rorschach?
Mick Foley, fat, wealthy.
Thinks he understands pain.
In any event, we will try to soldier on, and we probably won't be as entertaining as we were. But we are back with only the third installment of Hard Travelers for Hire, our movie-by-movie look at the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We started several months back with Iron Man, or Iron Man, if you will, the very first entry in the MCU. We followed it up with in The Incredible Hulk with Russell Sellers last month, and now we're back on more of a regular schedule with it, and so we're going to be taking a look at the third entry in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Iron Man 2, or if you prefer, Iron Man 2. I wouldn't dare make such a crass and obscure reference as that, but we'll be getting to that a little bit later on in the show, but first, we have a couple of recurring segments here, and to kick things off this week, unless you have anything else for our listeners before we get going, Nick.
No, let's get into it.
Let's start things out with a little segment we call
Reading and Watching. What you be reading and watching?
What you've been reading and watching.
So, it's been a jam-packed week of television in particular, but also some comic books. So where should we start, Nick? Where should we begin our journey with the listening?
Well, it's actually kind of a light week in the week of comic books for those of us who are reading weekly at this point, because it was a fifth Wednesday in the month, so a lot of annuals and stuff. So let's just go ahead and breeze through those real quick. It shouldn't take too long. I've only got five books that I read this week. So
I think I've got five as well. So
All right.
Let's get cracking.
Why don't you kick it off with your bottom book?
My bottom book. Ooh. Ooh, getting the negative out of the way. All right. Well, my bottom book of the time period is not a bad book, I don't think, but it was an easy choice nonetheless for my bottom book of the week. And that is Blue Beetle number 2 by Keith Giffen and Scott Collins. And this is continuing the story of Jaime Reyes and Ted Kord as they attempt to work together as the Blue Beetle. And again, it's not a bad book by any means. It's solid. It still, to me, has not lived up to the promise of the Rebirth special. The group known as the Posse is, I guess, mildly interesting, but not terribly. The family drama with Jaime Reyes is much more interesting to me. I'm interested in his relationship with his parents. Thought his mom was really good in here. I think Ted Kord continues to be written really well. I'm just not terribly invested in the Posse or the what appears to be the overarching story thus far. The dialogue was better in this issue than it was in number one. The action was pretty good. The art was good. But, again, just not lighting my world on fire in a DC Universe Rebirth initiative that overall is definitely lighting my world on fire. So that's my bottom pick.
Yeah, that was the book that actually, I mean, like you said, not terrible, but with the benchmark being set so high, that was actually the book, the issue that caused me to drop Blue Beetle was number 2. So I certainly understand where you're coming from there. For my bottom book of the week, I got a little bit of a surprise. I got an upset, a shocker, if you will, Greg.
Why?
My bottom book of the week.
Thanatos?
No. You don't even get me started. My bottom book of the week is Old Man Logan, number 14.
Wow. This book has perpetually been on top of your list.
That's right, but I got a good reason for it, Greg. This book is the first issue of the series to not feature Andrea Sorrentino on interior art. Couple that with the fact that it is a story. You know, Old Man Logan, for the most part, has been one of those Marvel stories that I enjoy most in that it's almost completely divorced from the Marvel from the larger Marvel universe at times, which doesn't require me to keep up with a whole lot of Marvel continuity. Well, in this one, I get a pretty good heap and helping of Marvel continuity, and more specifically, X-Men continuity. Jubilee features in this story, and I had no idea that Jubilee was A, vampire, or B, had a kid. So I was a little lost here, and then throw in a giant sentinel that the X-Men are seemingly keeping as some sort of pet slash servant, and a version of the Howling Commandos that is all anthropomorphic, walking, talking animals. And I was completely lost for most of this. So
that does not sound like a compelling version of the Howling Commandos.
Yeah, the writing was okay, I guess, but I was completely lost, and there was no Sorrentino art to pretty it up for me. So for this limited week, I'm going to have to go with Old Man Logan number 14 as my bottom book of the week.
Wow. Now, you said Jubilee has a kid. Well, who to Pappy?
I have no idea. I didn't know Jubilee had a kid.
Well, I didn't know if they explained who the paterfamilius was or not.
No, there's no explanation of the paterfamilias.
Sounds to me like somebody needs a paddling.
Well,
sounds
to me like somebody needs to stay out of the Woolsworth.
Everybody needs to stay out of the Woolsworth. All right, now, moving on to my number 3 top book of the week. It comes to us, all of us experience it, from the creative team of Dan Jurgens and Patrick Zercher, and it is Action Comics number 964. This is the conclusion of the Superman Meet Clark Kent storyline. And unlike Nick, I was heavily invested in this story, perhaps due to my history with Superman mythos. I find the mystery to be incredibly compelling as to who this Clark Kent is. I want to know more about him. I want to know what he's got up his sleeve. I definitely think he's nefarious. I think there are enough hints in this story that he is something nefarious, and really excited to see where that's going. I thought the art from Patrick Zercher was exceptional in places. The facial expressions, the poses of the characters, really, really good. The mystery continues to be good. It wasn't very action-packed for a book called Action Comics, admittedly, but I'm invested in the story enough that I could look past that. So I definitely enjoyed this one and look forward to seeing where it all goes.
Fair enough. My number three book of the week in a month, you know, like I said, it's a fifth Wednesday, so a lot of annuals this week for me, and my number three book of the week is Star Wars Annual Number 2. Not even really sure who wrote this, to be honest. Somebody named Thompson. but I really enjoyed this. It was pretty much a standalone story featuring an injured Princess Leia marooned on this planet that is ultimately neutral in the conflict between the Rebellion and the Empire. And she's taken in by somebody who trusts neither side and is able to show her essentially the good of the Rebellion over the course of this issue, and winds up recruiting a new soldier for the Rebellion. So enjoyed this book very much as a standalone Princess Leia story. I gotta say, I actually think I enjoyed this annual more than I did the 5-issue miniseries they did a while back that I believe was written by Mark Waid. So big props to Star Wars Annual Number 2.
Very good, very good. Moving on to my number 2 book of the week, and that would be the first part of Escape from Dinosaur Island, Superman number 8, by Peter Tomasi, Patrick Gleason, and Doug Monkey, the longtime Green Lantern artist. This is a book that has Superman and his son, John, get transported to Dinosaur Island, which is a big part of DC lore from days gone by. And along the way, they encounter the remnants of the Losers, a classic DC war hero group. And this is another action-packed, heart-filled issue of Superman dedicated to the late, great Darwin Cook. The father-son dynamic between Clark and John is incredible throughout this series and has been from the get-go. And to me, it's just a joy every time that I see those two on panel together, and they were the entirety of this issue. It was all from their perspective. Really enjoyable. Actually making me enjoy Krypto, who I've never been a fan of, spoiler alert, in the Superman mythos, but really making me enjoy Krypto, really making me enjoy John and Clark, and granted, the dinosaurs, not the most compelling villains, per se, if you want to call them villains. But in this case, I don't really read Superman for the villains right now. I read it for that father-son dynamic. So, big fan of this one.
Good for you. Glad to hear you enjoyed that. My number two book of the week is JLA number 10. This is an admittedly rushed finale to Brian Hitch's Justice League of America series that has been plagued by delay after delay. They're wrapping this up, I think, probably because they have another title coming out called Justice League of America, and they want to avoid some market confusion. So, while it is a bit rushed, the art is still pretty good in this one, and the story comes to a conclusion in a fashion that I would deem ultimately satisfying, if a bit truncated. So, enjoyed this one very much, and I think this JLA series has really shown that Brian Hitch can write a solid Justice League title. I don't know what happened when he transitioned over to the main Justice League title with Rebirth, but if you want some Brian Hitch Justice League, now that this one's over, go out and find the 10 issues of Justice League of America that are out there.
Yep, all the alien invasions you could possibly ask for. And bringing me to my number one book of the time period, the past week, that I've read, still in my catch-up mode, of course, and that would be what was a book that just spoke to my heart. Action Comics number 966 by Dan Jurgens, and I believe Steven Segovia drew that one. I don't have it next to me. But this is the conclusion of the two-part story, Lois Lane Back at the Planet. Anybody that's listened to our show for a long time knows Lois is my favorite female character in all of comics. And this was a love letter to Lois fans. This is Lois at her smartest, at her bravest, at her boldest. She's back in her natural role as the investigative reporter. She gets her mojo back. She has a purpose now besides just raising her son. She's been doing that for so long. And unlike the New 52 version of Lois, she's front and center. It's her story. And it's a combination of that classic investigative reporter somewhat attitudinal version of Lois and the loving mother and wife that we've seen in the pages of Superman, Lois and Clark, and in the pages of Superman and Action Comics to this point. So it's really a return to form for Lois, putting her front and center where she belongs. And I think a whole new generation of kids and readers anyway, maybe not kids, but readers are going to fall in love with Lois the same way I did when I was a kid, reading her written by Dan Jurgens and other great writers from that era. So double thumbs up for Action Comics 966.
Well, continuing on the Superman kick, my number one book of the week is Superman Annual number 1. There are a variety of approaches you can take with annuals. Like the Star Wars annual that I praised earlier mostly told a standalone story that, yes, it featured one of the major characters, but it kind of, you know, isn't really essential reading to the story. You could also do what Batman Annual did this week and kind of tell, you know, use it as an anthology book, essentially, to tell a variety of stories. But I really like the approach in Superman number one. Or Superman Annual 1. It was a story that I don't think it's required reading for the current storyline going on in Superman, but it certainly enhances the storyline. And what happens here is it's an encounter between Superman and Swamp Thing, where Swamp Thing is basically blaming Superman for causing a disturbance in the Green because the Green is reacting negatively to Superman's vibrational attunement because Superman is not of this Earth. And so Swamp Thing, he seeks to help Superman become more attuned to this Earth and seem to fit in and be a more natural part. And it winds up being, a physical confrontation between the two characters, but very much also an emotional realization for Superman that he has to let go of the Earth that was and embrace the Earth he's on now. So I really, really enjoyed this one. Superman Annual number 1 made great usage of the increased real estate, you know, the expanded oversized $4.99 annual. Tomasi and Gleason with Jorge Jimenez on art. I mean, just an outstanding job by these guys on an annual issue. So if you're going to check out one annual from this past week, I highly recommend Superman Annual number 1.
Really looking forward to that one. It's in my list. That's a nice throwback to the classic Alan Moore Swamp Thing Superman crossover from the 80s that I was just talking about on another podcast that was recorded recently that will come out here very shortly. So very cool, very cool. It's a couple of quick hits from me. Action Comics number 965.
Did you read nothing but Superman this past week?
Largely. I read one other book in addition to Superman, but Action 965 was the first part of Lois Lane Back at the Planet. It was good, but a little too wrapped up and set up for me. There wasn't really a whole lot of Lois doing stuff. It was more her reacting to stuff, if you will, being put in weird situations. And it was good, solid, but not as strong or as feel-good to me as 966 was. So a solid book. Do you want to bring out one of yours, or should I do my next one?
My only quick hit of the week, I got Batman Annual number 1. As I just mentioned, this is an anthology-type approach to the annual. It tells a variety of stories. A lot of them seem to be somewhat holiday-themed. The biggest noteworthy piece of this annual to me was the fact that we had Neil Adams back on some Batman art drawing a little Harley Quinn-related holiday story. Mm. So very much enjoyed that. Batman Annual number 1, a good read, if not essential to the current Batman storyline.
Yep. Batman number 10 is my next quick hit. I think this is probably going to be the biggest surprise to you, Nick, and that I didn't dig it that much. This was the one that had the letter from Catwoman as the narration throughout, which I enjoyed. I enjoy the Bruce Selina dynamic immensely, as everybody knows. I enjoyed that aspect of it. I got to be honest, I could not make a lick of sense out of what was going on in this comic book. I didn't think the artist, Mikael Janin, is usually tremendous, but in this issue, I couldn't tell the sequence of events that was going on. Like the action when he's in the pit of water, I cannot tell. Does his bat give out? I don't know what happens when he's climbing up these rivets that he's made. I didn't understand why he was repeating himself over and over again. I know a lot of this will probably be answered in 11, but as a standalone comic, this did not work for me. I didn't hate it, but I kind of wish
rivets. He was using the rivets to pop his back into place after Bane had injured him.
But how did he stand up to do it? It didn't make sense. They showed him. It's clearly what was supposed to be the illusion of him having his back broken again. And then he just stands up in the water and unnecessarily pops. It just didn't make sense to me. And for me, again, the narration, great with the Catwoman letter. I would have rather the issue been about Batman and Catwoman than any of the Bane stuff, because it just I couldn't make any sense out of it. I also don't know why Bane's still naked. Whatever. We'll find out as we move along, but not nearly as strong as 9, in my opinion.
Fair enough. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Do you have? Oh, that's the end of your quick hits.
That's it. That's all I got.
All you got. Now let's move on to watching a loaded week of what you're watching. The last loaded week, by the way, because Supergirl is now over for the mid-season, and when we come back next week, we'll have mid-season finales for Flash, Arrow, Legends, and Walking Dead. Mm-hmm. But for now, let's break into the big story of last week, TV-wise and comics, which was the Heroes versus Aliens, quote, four-night crossover.
Now, before we get started, have you actually watched Supergirl?
Yes.
Have you watched the previous week's Supergirl that you hadn't watched before?
No.
Good Lord, Greg.
Well, listen, time...
You watched Supergirl out of order?
Yes. I guessed it would have happened.
All right. You guessed at what had happened.
Well, the thing is...
Which is great for the purposes of our show.
Well, the thing is, time has been very difficult for me lately. As you know, I had a certain football game I had to watch on Saturday, and then I had other things, wrestling on Sunday night, as you know, and out-of-town trips in between and stuff. So all kinds of stuff going on in Greg Land. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, Supergirl, I thought, was a very good episode this week. A very satisfying episode. My only issue is that CW marketed this as a four-night crossover, and it was a three-night and about five-minute crossover. And I have a huge issue with that.
Yeah, that's mostly true. But again, I understand the logic that the showrunners gave, which was this was serving as Supergirl's mid-season finale, so they had to be more focused on wrapping up, you know, the individual storylines for that show rather than tying too much into the crossover. So while I wish they had scheduled better, I understand why things had to go down the way they did.
Quite frankly, I'd suggest that if they knew that was coming, which they did as their show, they should have not done the two prior boring episodes and use that real estate.
Now, quite frankly, you didn't watch the prior episodes.
I'm talking about the ones before that one. The last two before that one were not good episodes. We talked about it right here on this very show, Nicholas. We said those two episodes were the bottom of the week for each respective week because they were boring and uneventful largely, and they should have used that real estate to help wrap up their Supergirl story. So then they would have had that real estate this week, more time, another hour they could have used for this crossover to stretch things out a little bit more and help the pacing issues. Or, alternatively, if they couldn't do that, at the very least, Nick, you'd have to agree, they shouldn't have marketed it as a four-night crossover event.
From an ideal standpoint and from an altruistic standpoint, yeah, they shouldn't have marketed it, you know, the way they did. But, Greg, let's be honest. If you were working for them and you were like, hey, we'd really like to get some high ratings, what would you have done?
Not that, and I'll tell you why, Nick, because I can tell you, if they had done a crossover episode, maybe somebody watches that episode, like last year when they crossed over with The Flash, somebody watches that episode and says, hey, this Supergirl show is better than I heard it was. I think I'm going to start watching that now and give it a chance, which a lot of people did. I can tell you, I've talked to many people that have done that, at least five that I can count in my head that watched Supergirl because of The Flash crossover and decided, hey, I'm willing to invest in this show a little bit. Here's what happened this past week to somebody that I know. I don't watch Supergirl. Okay, I guess I should watch it tonight because The Flash is going to be on there. Flash isn't on there until the last 2-3 minutes of the show. Okay, I'm not watching this show ever again. I'm done with this. It's not important. You know? And also,
I mean,
the other aspect of that is that was going to be, if you're doing a crossover episode, it's somebody's first episode they've ever watched. And largely, especially in the case of Supergirl, which is not as tied into the other three shows, you can't drop them in the middle of all of these you know, dangling subthreads and expect them to pick everything up and then not give them any crossover appeal, not give them Flash at least. So I had a huge issue with the way they put this episode together, even though it was a good episode. Like, for Supergirl fans, it was a good episode, but it did not follow through on what they promised, and I worry that it may have turned more people off than it brought in.
I don't have that concern as much as you do, and it didn't bother me nearly as much as it did you. We got a good episode of Supergirl, and I've enjoyed Supergirl this season, so color me pleased with what we got, although I do wish there had been a little bit more of the crossover than what wound up happening.
Now, let's go to Tuesday night. As a result of not having the time to do the crossover on Supergirl, The Flash was incredibly rushed. And so we had a whole bunch of stuff happening in a very small amount of time. Although, I enjoyed the hell out of it. I thought it was super entertaining. This was an actual crossover episode where we got Supergirl brought in, we got Oliver brought in and his team, Oliver and company, as they said, all of them brought in. We got Flash's crew brought in. We even got the Legends crew brought in. So this introduced us to the Dominators. This gave us the basic premise of this crossover event. And I enjoyed the hell out of it. I thought the team dynamics were great. The humor was on point. The character moments were really good. Could have done without Mopey Sisko, but thank God they appear – we're jumping ahead a little bit with this, but thank God they appear to have done away once again with Mopey Sisko, hopefully for good. But other than Mopey Sisko, yeah. I don't have a lot of complaints. I thought it was a fun episode.
Yeah, it was a good episode. I mean, I kind of think it was a little bit too rushed because you went from
– Again, they had to because of Supergirl. They didn't have the time.
They didn't necessarily have to because of Supergirl, because as we'll discuss, there was an entire other episode of the crossover that had practically nothing to do with the crossover, much like Supergirl, that we're not complaining about because of how much it tickled our fanboy fancies. So, you know, it was a little too rushed for me. The whole dynamic of the team is together, and they instantly went from, hey, we're together, to we don't trust Barry, to we're being mind-wiped. It was just everything felt like it was kind of on fast forward a little bit. But that being said, you know, I did enjoy the action aspects of the episode. I enjoyed the little snippets of what we got of, you know, Oliver and Diggle especially interacting with Kara. So, you know, there was a lot of stuff to like in this episode, but I really feel like this episode of Flash was really setting the stage for two superior episodes of television that would follow on Wednesday and Thursday nights.
I would agree with that. I would definitely agree with that. So I don't really have a whole lot else to say about Flash. I don't remember it that well, to be honest. It was just kind of like, like you said, the introductory chapter of this crossover. I just remember it being fun and having good interactions between all the cast members. Now, moving on to Wednesday night, the aforementioned episode of Arrow, which we kind of, I think we may have mentioned this a couple weeks ago, Nick, refresh me if I'm wrong, that it was going to be Arrow's version of my favorite Batman the Animated Series episode, Perchance to Dream. We may not have talked about that. If not, I apologize, folks, but that's basically what this was. If you haven't seen it, Perchance to Dream was a classic episode of Batman in which Bruce wakes up to find out that his whole life as Batman had been a lie, that his parents were still alive, that he was engaged to Selina Kyle. It's a beautiful episode of television, in my opinion anyway. And this was kind of Arrow's version of that. In the Flash episode, Oliver Queen, Sarah Lance, and John Diggle, and Ray Palmer, I think, right?
Ray Palmer.
Are abducted Palmer, by the Dominators. And kind of...
basically all the characters that started on Arrow.
On Arrow.
Except for Felicity.
Yes. They're abducted by the Dominators, and much like Mongol when he placed the Black Mercy on Superman in the classic Whatever Happened, or not Whatever Happened, the classic For the Man Who Has Everything story in the comics, the Dominators decide to just find out as much as they can about these heroes by putting them into a dream world and kind of negating them from the equation, basically, and probing their subconscious in the process. So Oliver, Ray, Sarah, and Diggle are in this shared hallucinatory world where the Queen's Gambit never went down because Oliver never got on it. So the Queens are still alive. Robert and Moira Queen are together and alive. Tommy Merlin is still alive. Although he only appears in hologram form near the end of the episode, although we'll get to the best line of the episode in a minute. But the and Oliver is engaged to Laurel. So it's basically how the world would have played out had he never gotten on the Queen's Gambit. And meanwhile, back in Starling City, in the boring part of the episode, the rest of Team Arrow has called in the Flash and Supergirl and Cisco to help them. Unfortunately, still mopey Cisco at this point, correct? To try and help them, I guess you would say, get their friends out of the Dominator spaceship.
Help them to locate their friends. They don't know exactly where they're being held and all that, and they have to figure out what the deal is.
Right. So those parts of the episode, honestly, were not great even good. The we got Wild Dog right back to his annoying old self as he suddenly doesn't like metahumans. So he gives a little bit of lip to Kara and Barry during the episode.
And how about in the midst of an alien invasion, which is pretty much like the most high-pressure situation this team has been in, Evelyn Sharp is nowhere to be found, and no one seems to think that this is suspicious at all.
Well, given how ineffective she's been on the show, I'm not sure it would have made a difference.
Right, but given the reveal of the previous episode, I would argue that she's not doing a very good job of, you know, maintaining her cover at this point.
Right, right. But luckily, the rest of the team are, as we've discussed every week here on the show, Curtis and what's-his-face, Wild Dog, are not exactly the sharpest knives in the drawer, it appears. So perhaps they just...
Hey, Ragman's okay.
Oh, yeah, right. Ragman's good. Yeah, I got nothing against him. And honestly, Curtis would be fine if he wouldn't try to be a superhero. So those parts of the episode, I don't know about you, Nick, I thought they were really boring.
Well, they were really boring, but luckily I think they only amounted to about
it was a very small fort.
Like 8 to 10 minutes maybe of screen time tops. I mean, this episode was almost entirely focused on the Dream World, which is fine because much like Supergirl, this episode had to serve a dual purpose. This happened to be Arrow's 100th episode in show history, and thus it had the purpose of serving as both a crossover episode and something of a commemorative look back at what the show has been to this point. So it kind of had to serve two masters, like I said, much like Supergirl did, but I think it did it a little bit better, and I think this was one of the best episodes of Arrow that we've had, man, in a long time, since some of the high points of Season 3, at least.
Yeah, it was incredible. It really, really worked on me. I mean, everybody in the cast stepped up and delivered, even as much as we've ragged on her over the years, deservedly so, I'd argue. I thought Laurel was really good in this episode. Katie Cassidy did a great job. Moira and Robert Queen. I mean, Stephen Amell talked about this on Facebook, about how the guy that played Robert Queen hasn't played that character in over 4 years. He was only that character for basically part of one episode, and he stepped back in.
Well, there were also some flashbacks to him on the raft that were shown later on. So maybe 2-3 episodes tops, but I would imagine they probably shot a lot of that
at the same time. And he stepped in like it was nothing and seemed natural and seemed like he was part of the show. All the actors were tremendous here. I especially enjoyed seeing Diggle as almost a more hardened version of Green Arrow. It almost got me to the point where I'm like, damn, I really want to see David Ramsey get a chance to play a superhero of his own in his own show at some point, because he's definitely – I don't want to see him leave Arrow, but he's definitely got the chops to pull off being a street-level vigilante for sure.
Man, if only there were a street-level vigilante in the DC universe, that would be a perfect fit for David Ramsey that, you know, wasn't being played by a terrible version of another character. But I digress.
Yes, that he certainly would make a better guardian than James Olsen.
Yes.
Metrosexual James Olsen.
Now, what makes him metrosexual?
Well, he's just very prim and proper, it seems. He doesn't have the ruggedness of somebody that would be guardian to me.
Or the ruggedness of Jimmy Olsen.
Or the ruggedness of Jimmy Olsen, even. Nobody has the ruggedness of Jimmy Olsen except David Sunday, though.
Or young Rorschach.
Rorschach, I would caution you. you might say, actually, when you're looking back at this episode, that it was not ugly. very, very beautiful. But
you might say that somewhere right now, David Sunday is attempting to trap viscous fluids between two layers of fabric.
Oh God! Let's just do that podcast again. But what I was trying to get to is, all that being said, everyone was great, but this was the Stephen Amell show.
Yep.
I mean, he gave a tour de force. For people that have been watching the show since the first episode, this was just an incredible emotional tour through Oliver Queen's tortured existence, and Amell gave a dynamite performance. I had concerns about whether they would be able to match the emotion and the drama of the moment when Bruce, in Perchance to Dream, has to accept that he's leaving the dream world, or the moment in For the Man Who Has Everything when Superman has to choose to leave the Black Mercy dream world. He absolutely nailed it. The scene where he said goodbye to his parents, gotta be honest, that was a real tugging at the heartstrings moment. So hell of a job by Amell in this one.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. My only real disappointing part of this episode was I was a little bummed not to see Tommy and not to see Manu Bennett back as Deathstroke. You know, we get Deathstroke in the episode, but he never takes the mask off, so you don't get any Slade-Ollie interactions that I was kind of hoping for.
Yeah.
Beggars can't be choosers.
And we did
get
hologram
ultimately.
Tommy, and we did get the line of the episode when they talk about the fact that Tommy couldn't make it to the wedding because he's now a doctor in Chicago, which if people follow the actor who played Tommy, he is currently playing a doctor in the hit medical show Chicago. Was it Chicago Med, I think is the name of it? Anyway, it's a big hit. People love it. So good for him. And it was hilarious that they managed to work that joke in. So good stuff.
Yeah, great episode, though, all around. Really, really enjoyed it, even if it wasn't very crossover heavy. Which, of course, brings us to the last episode of the week. And this one was, I would argue, the best of the actual crossover episodes. I'm not counting Arrow as part of that, because Arrow, as we just said, was almost more concerned with doing his own thing. But I thought Legends, in wrapping up the Heroes vs. Aliens crossover, absolutely knocked it out of the park. Every character got a moment to shine. The story that was told was, you know, much tighter and much better paced than the story they told in the Flash episode. All in all, really, really loved this one, and loved how they managed to work time travel into it so that it both felt like a crossover episode and a Legends episode, which it was.
Yep. Totally agree. Yeah, this was really good. I very much enjoyed this. This had so many fist-pumping moments, so many great character dynamics, so many wonderful moments for each character to shine. I thought that was the other thing this episode did. Every character truly got a chance to shine in this episode, whether it was Heatwave, whether it was Steel, whether it was even Vixen for a moment, whether it was the casts of Arrow and Flash. Everybody got a chance to do something. I wanted to give a specific shout-out, and I'm sure Todd Weber appreciated this too, actually seeing Firestorm use Firestorm powers. Because for those that don't read the comics, Firestorm's ability is not shooting fire at people. That's not just what he does. He can transmute things. He can literally change things at an elemental level. And so to see him get to use his Firestorm powers for the first time in a long time was awesome. Really enjoyed that.
Yeah, that was a cool moment. And I really enjoyed the Martin Stein aspect of this episode more than I thought I would. I thought they did a good job of kind of making you understand his the emotional dilemma he faces right now. And I feel for the guy. It's a great storyline that for a character that they too often don't really give storylines. He's just kind of there to be the science guy of the team.
Mm-hmm. Agreed with that. Also, one thing that I loved about this crossover in general is this universe started with Arrow and the Flash, and it ended with Arrow and the Flash, this crossover. I thought the crossover was very much weighted in the Barry-Oliver relationship, kind of with Sarah Lance as the third proxy. But the fact that whole postscript with Barry and Ollie going to the bar was such a great feel-good moment for the people that have been following these shows. I absolutely adored it. I thought it was great. great lines about referring back to their first meeting when they had the competition with each other, and Oliver saying, well, the first time or the second time was a draw. And so, you know, challenging him to another duel, basically. And just seeing their kind of budding bromance was really cool, I thought.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Enjoyed that a great deal. And it was also fun to see those two characters basically argue over who deserves more blame for the
yes.
for the way the world is, which is very indicative of those two characters.
Right, given their how their casts of their respective shows tend to blame them for everything that happens in the world. So we actually had an off-air debate about who has taken the blame for more things at this point, Barry or Oliver, and it's pretty close.
Yeah, it's pretty close. I'm still going to say Oliver, but you know.
Yeah, well, that's why I love the fact. One of my favorite scenes, and I can't remember if it was in The Flash or if it was in Legends, but one of my favorite scenes of this entire crossover was when Barry, of all people, who's blamed himself for so many things. I'm sorry, Oliver, who's blamed himself for so many things, pulled Barry aside and, like, gave him a pep talk about how it's not his fault and that he shouldn't waste his time blaming himself and that he was doing what he thought was right. See, having Oliver in that rare position of giving the pep talk about not blaming yourself was awesome. Really appreciated that. And, again, great job by everybody in this crossover. All the actors, I mean, were outstanding throughout this crossover. So hopefully next year it'll be paced out a little bit better. I definitely agree with you on that. I think there's more real estate to deal with over four episodes, and they can hopefully let the story breathe a little bit more next year. But super fun. The last episode was just a tour de force action-wise. I think both of us were surprised and excited that the CGI held up as well as it did, too, in the climactic battle scene.
Yeah, it had some low moments throughout the crossover, but they did a good enough job of kind of hiding the Dominators in shadow for a large portion of the time. But like you said, when it came down for the final climactic scene, I thought the CGI held up pretty well.
Yep. And that's the end of our CW crossover, so let's rank them for the week. For me, I will go Arrow, Legends, Flash, Supergirl. What about you, Nick?
Arrow, Legends, Supergirl, Flash.
Very good. Now, this brings us to Sunday night and a brand new episode of AMC's The Walking Dead, coming off of what Nick and I thought was the worst episode of the season. This was a little bit of a scattershot episode, but mainly focused on Carl infiltrating, if you will, Negan's camp, and that not going very well for old Carl. And I thought this
Who could have seen that coming.
I thought this was a great episode. I thought they rebounded with one of the better episodes of the season. I greatly enjoyed this one. Jeffrey Dean Morgan gave a killer performance in this one as Negan, unsettling but really, really funny as well, including one of the best lines of the season thus far. I'm at least 50% more into you now.
Yeah, Negan was great in this episode. The only way he could have been better is if he would have just killed Carl outright, as he should have.
Now Carl was good.
He killed two of his guys!
And he should have! At this point, I don't feel bad for any of Negan's guys.
Right, but I'm saying that Carl does not understand the situation that he is in because he's an idiot, Greg.
Well, like, I would suggest
your disdain for Rick put aside, at least Rick understands that he finds himself faced with virtually insurmountable odds, or at the very least, insurmountable given the resources he currently has at his disposal. Carl, on the other hand, seems to think that he can just bulldoze his way through this issue, and it's not going to work out. And I'm hoping, against all hopes, that all the rumors are true and that the god-awful what's the kid's name? I've already forgotten the kid. Chandler Riggs. I'm hoping that Chandler Riggs can go off to godforsaken Auburn University and leave the damn show via brutal Lucille beating.
We're not here to offend any people that may be attending Auburn University.
I hope he goes off to godforsaken Auburn University and leaves the show via brutal Lucille beating.
I will say Chandler Riggs did a hell of a job in this episode. He was really good. The Negan was really good. And I would argue, I have had this question from the beginning, why doesn't someone just nut up and shoot Negan and then let the chips fall where they may? I mean, yeah, you're probably going to die in the process, but But without a leader, what are these people? Who's going to step up and be the new leader of these people? Dwight? None of these people have enough balls to be the new leader.
Dwight was very unsettling in the one episode we got an extended look at him. So I wouldn't sell. Not Dwight.
You're talking about the mustache man.
Oh, what's the guy who said is his right hand man?
Yeah,
what's
the mustache guy.
Not Dwight.
Just call him Mustache. I don't know his name.
The point being, that guy is very unsettling.
He
even has made it clear that he's his right hand man. And the Savior's MO, Greg, is not that you are going to die. It's that other people that you care about are going to
die.
So even if you don't have a regard for yourself, you should have a regard for those you love and care about. It's a lesson that Carl is being is being teased very much with learning here pretty soon.
Whose rule is that? Is that the Savior's rule or is that Negan's rule?
They are all Negan, though. They have all bought into this system of belief, Greg.
Are you saying
it's not as simple?
Like Jeff Jarrett? When he joined Immortal, he didn't sell out. He bought in.
The point is that it's not as simple as Carl and Rosita would like to think it is, where one bullet solves all the problems. It is a larger problem that simple minds like Carl and Rosita can't wrap their heads
around. Get out of here. Get out of here with simple minds. Simple minds. I would suggest that Rosita...
Which is why, I might add, that when a simple mind like Rosita can't wrap her head around the issue, there is a voice of reason trying to explain to her the reality.
You and your hard-on for Eugene
and the reality,
always get
the reality
the
of things is that Dr. Eugene Porter is a man to be listened
First
to.
First of all, he's not a doctor.
His name is Dr.
He
Eugene
is not
Porter.
A doctor.
He's a doctor.
He is not a doctor. He's never gone to medical school.
He worked at the Human Genome Project, Greg.
Human Genome Project. That's right. In any event, I would say everything about this episode I liked a lot, except Spencer.
I don't think you're supposed to.
No. He's a heel. He is absolutely right. A heel. But I wasn't enthralled by Spencer and his. Now, luckily, it wasn't a big part of the episode. His jaunt through the woods. Nor was I enthralled by Rick and the other guy searching for supplies. And I don't even know why they showed them, to be honest, in this episode. They weren't doing anything.
To get across the fact that Alexandria is basically terrified at this point because they don't have anything to offer Negan once he returns.
Right, right.
And so you have these disparate groups going out to try and, you know, basically come up with some sort of offering to appease the beast.
Yes, absolutely.
So
my counter would be that as the maker of a television show, you have to make it interesting to watch. And there was nothing interesting to watch about Rick and that guy waking up in their trailer and then walking through the woods and encountering nothing.
They encountered walkers in the water.
Walkers in the water. That was super exciting. the Negan stuff was outstanding with Carl and Olivia. And, all that stuff was great. Daryl, the iron. We get to see a little bit more in this episode, I think, of how Negan's twisted psychology works. In that he has all of these wives, but I don't know if he has convinced himself that they're there of their own free will, or if he thinks in his mind, or if he's just doing that to screw with them, basically, that he views it as their ultimate punishment is to be with him. I don't know how he views it exactly, but it's very unsettling and uncomfortable and not cool. So they're really building up Negan as the he's definitely one of the best heels on television, I would say.
Absolutely. And with the mid-season finale coming up, somebody has got to die. And, they're teasing me, Greg. They're teasing me with it.
What are they teasing you with?
God, it needs to be Carl. It needs to be Carl. It's time for Carl to go. It's time. It's time. It's time. It's time. It's Negan time.
Wow, there's a pull. Negan is going to challenge Will Ospreay. To a shoot fight?
Well, Will Ospreay, you know, there for a little while, didn't need to cut his hair, just like Carl needs to cut his damn hair.
Well, he does need to cut his hair, I agree.
Speaking of which, Carl bursting out into tears because Negan is making fun of his eye. For God's sake, is this kid supposed to be a badass or an idiot? I can't decide.
He's a teenager! Even Negan pointed out. He's 14 or 15 or whatever the hell he is in the show. I don't know how old he is in the show. 16, whatever.
He's also an idiot.
He's an idiot.
For the record.
He's an idiot. A lot of people on The Walking Dead are idiots, though. Let's be honest.
That's true.
There's a lot of...
Carl is just the idiot that continues to inexplicably survive all these situations.
Unfortunately, Nick, you...
Getting shot in the stomach, getting shot in the eye, going into the Savior's camp and killing two people. Nothing can kill this kid at this point.
You and I both know that lovely, beautiful Rosita is going to be the one that dies.
I would tend to agree, although I must admit, somewhat concerned for the fate of my beloved Dr. Eugene Porter.
They're both candidates, sadly. I would hate to lose either one of them, but I feel like that's going to be the case. What would be great is if Spencer got it.
I actually think there's a reasonable chance that Spencer is going to get it.
That would be cool, too.
Because my belief is that, at this point, Negan wants Rick in charge because he likes dealing with Rick. And I think Negan will see right through Spencer's self-serving intention of taking over leadership of the group with Negan's blessing. And he will not take kindly to that. And he will, you know, in his own twisted sense of morals, perform Rick a favor by taking Spencer out of the equation.
Yeah, Negan's an interesting cat. It's really interesting the way they've laid out his psyche and his persona. Because from what I've read up on Wikipedia about the comic version of Negan, this version of Negan might be even a little less moral than the comic book version. So very interesting there to see how that all plays out. But overall,
What about Michonne? What the hell is Michonne doing?
Oh, yeah, Michonne. She's wanting to go to Negan as well. I don't know if she's wanting revenge. I don't know if she wants to barter. I don't know what her plan is. But right,
all these people are idiots. It's basically what.
Or
I'm
maybe
at.
They've got courage and Rick doesn't.
There's a difference between courage and stupidity, Greg.
In The Walking Dead, I'd argue there isn't.
I will disagree.
Rick has persistently shown that he is an idiot. So you know it's. Everybody on the show has, to be honest. There's barely anybody on the show right now that you can point at and say, wow, that person has really made great decisions. But what kind of decisions would we make if we were in the zombie apocalypse and had been betrayed by so many people over the years? So really, you know. Did you catch the Kirkman moment in the episode?
What Kirkman moment?
The Kirkman moment when they're sitting in the car. Two unrelated characters are sitting in the car and the only person they're talking about is Rick.
I guess that is a Kirkman moment, I suppose.
Oh, come on. We talked about it on the walk.
Although one of the characters is tearing down Rick, so it's not really a Kirkman moment.
But the other, that's true. That's a good point. But the other character is quick to say, well, I think we all are in tough situations. Rick's a good man doing the best that he can. Which, if it was in the comic book, would have then had three or four other characters who weren't even in the scene show up out of nowhere to say, yep, he's right.
Quite frankly.
But overall, what'd you think? I thought it was a good episode.
Yeah, I enjoyed the episode. I enjoyed the episode very much. I'm intrigued to see how they, you know, they always have some kind of cliffhanger for us at the midseason. So I'm interested to see what that is.
What do you think the hope spot's going to be? Because they got to get at a certain point, they're going to have to give people a hope spot with regards to Negan.
My hope spot will be if he you know acts like he's going to kill Carl. That's my hope spot, but I don't know that it's coming. As I told Danielle, we were sitting there watching it. He won't kill Carl because he's supposed to be a villain. They don't want to turn him into the biggest baby face on television.
Oh, man. Man, you really want
instant baby face turn. Instant turn. He becomes the most over face in all the television landscape.
I bet you became a little bit aroused when he threatened Daryl that he was going to poke out Carl's one good eye.
I don't care about maiming at this point. I just want the kid dead. I want him dead. I want him off the show.
He's dead.
That's right.
And with that brings an end to watching. Now, have you finished?
He can go eat pudding and skate up there in that great big compound in the sky.
Listen, in the world of The Walking Dead, I'm sure there's a certain former comedian who's got some pudding ready for Carl up in heaven or you know, wherever. And
I bet that comedian and Negan would be good friends.
They would. I bet they just have a. They just have a blast coming up with new ways to entertain the wives.
He'd enjoy Negan's harem.
Mm. In any event, that brings a merciful end to watching. And do we want to talk at all about episode 4 of Batman Telltale, or are you still working with...
No, I haven't finished yet.
Gotcha. All right, we'll do that next time. Let's go to a very quick version of the rundown. We don't have much for you this week. Not a lot going on towards the end of the year here. But we're going to kick things off with we talked last episode about some of these new X-Men titles that are coming out for Resurrection. And we got the official announcements of three new X-Men ongoings. One being Iceman, which is launching very soon from Marvel Comics as well. It's part of the Resurrection Initiative. And this, as is kind of a trend with this, has kind of somewhat of an unknown creative team. A recent Marvel recruit, Sina Grace, is going to be writing it. And Alessandro Vitti, who DC fans will know from Red Lanterns, is going to be the artist on the book. And it's going to focus on Iceman's sexuality, which has been an issue in recent years of him, the adult version of Iceman, accepting that he is in fact gay, as the younger version of himself has brought to his attention.
Yes, the younger version came out somewhat publicly, and now the adult version is having to deal with the younger version, who is also him being gay.
Listen, it's all quite technical.
But the important thing is that Iceman's sexuality is secure.
That's right. Didn't you get the memo? And yes, I've gone cross-eyed. So that's one book, and you know, I don't know anything about the writer to say what the.
No, but it's a somewhat interesting concept,
sure,
from
absolutely.
The sexuality angle alone, and I feel like that's going to speak to a large number of
absolutely.
People that. The X-Men as a franchise should be speaking to, you know, the disenfranchised.
Absolutely.
Ostracized and whatnot. So probably not a book that I'm going to buy. I may check it out and trade or something, but it's a book that I'm glad will be existing in the
meantime. Exactly. Yep, exactly. Not something that, like, necessarily screams or appeals like it's going to be for me. I've never been a big Iceman fan, but for those that are, Ben Morris, I know he said that was his favorite X-Man. For people that are really into Iceman or people that just – are disenfranchised like that, I think it's going to be a great book for them to try out, and hopefully it'll deliver in the quality department. Generation X, similarly, a relaunched title, which was famous in the 90s, a huge book in the 90s, is being relaunched with a colorist-turned writer, Christina Strain, along with artist, help me out with this name, Amilcar Pena?
Let's go with that.
They will be reviving the book. And it's basically a team of what they're calling lovable losers who are outsiders in a new Xavier's Institute that's set in Central Park. And the twist on this one is, for those that remember the original Generation X, which launched in 1994, Scott Lobdell, lots of fanfare at the time for this book. It even got its own television movie, which we will review at some point on and off the page. But this Jubilee was part of that team. It was Emma Frost and Banshee were the headmaster and headmistress of the group, and it was all the young mutants at the time. It was basically a new version of New Mutants, and you had Jubilee, you had Husk, you had Skin. You had a lot of different characters there. Well, anyway, in this group, Jubilee is going to be leading the team, and they're kind of the oddball X-Men, the mutants that have.
I don't know a single one of these characters, not a one.
The mutants that have very unusual powers. Kind of think of them as like the Doom Patrol of Marvel, if you will. So you've got Quentin Quire, who I believe was a Grant Morrison creation. Boy,
sure. Uh-huh.
Benjamin Deeds, Nature Girl,
yeah, that guy,
Blaine,
uh-huh.
And a
uh-huh.
new psychometric mutant.
The fuck does that
I don't
mean?
Know what that means. Named Nathaniel Carver, which isn't a
okay,
which isn't a terribly interesting name for a mutant, but is a mutant nonetheless. But no, the premise is going to be taking these really weird and different characters and putting them in an X-Men group. So I'm all for it. Hey, give it a shot. I'm interested
yeah,
enough
sure,
in this to give it a try. Not in single issue form, granted, but I will give it a see the review, see how it looks, and see if it's worth picking up in trade form. And Chamber is apparently going to show up. I know you don't know who Chamber is. Chamber was
nope.
a huge part of the original Generation X, and has kind of been in limbo for a while. So I'm excited to see that. So looking forward to Generation X, although, I don't know anything about the creative team, so I'm not super excited about it. But still, good for those that are.
Yeah, yes. Sure, why not?
Just say yes and we'll move along.
Yes, and we'll move
along. And then, speaking of books that I'm not terribly excited about, but I'm happy for those who are, Jean Grey getting her own book. Finally, after all these years, Jean Grey number one will launch by writer Dennis Hopeless and artist Victor Ibanez. And it's going to focus on the time-displaced young version of Jean Grey as she fights...
Yeah, because I think adult Jean Grey is dead right now, correct?
She is in one of her many death spells, yes. And has been for a while, actually. And anyway, she is trying to understand her connection with the Phoenix Force. And he describes it as a sort of Trials of Hercules story. Jean gets a premonition of sorts. And I'm sure, from what I understand, Senior Benjamin and Vanguard One will be showing up. So, I mean, I'm sure there's an audience out there for this.
Well, you know, it makes sense. The grounds of the Xavier Institute, they do need some keeping. And who better to do the groundskeeping than one Senior Benjamin?
Okay, Mr. Xavier. Very good, Mr. Xavier. Anyway, these have not exactly lit my world on fire. Again, I am of the era of kids that came kind of after the Claremont Byrne classic X-Men stories where Jean was one of the best characters in comics. I kind of grew up with Jean being a little bit on the boring side, so I've never been a huge fan of hers either. I like her being around, but I've never liked her as the focus of a story necessarily. But she's getting her book, and hopefully it'll be good. I have my issues with the time-displaced X-Men in general, but we'll see how it turns out. So that is...
It's not an episode of the Hard Traveling Fanboys without Greg mentioning his issues with the time-displaced X-Men.
I've done it twice, Nick. This is the second week that I've done it.
I'm just saying.
Just say it. What?
If I'm an anti-Archite, then you're an anti-time displacian.
Okay, I'll own that. Unlike you, I'll own it. I'll own it. I'll say it right now to all the pro-time displacians out there. I'm anti-time displacian.
You'll own it because it's true, whereas the labels you try to slap on me are blatantly false.
That is not even remotely true. You're anti-Elizabeth Townian.
That's true. Yes, I will own that one the way you own your anti.
And you are an anti-Archite.
That is not true.
Listen, you've been trying to paint me as the world's biggest Jeff Jarrett fan for 10 goddamn years. I am slapping you with the anti-Archite.
Well, now we're getting off the format sheet, brother. Now we're shooting.
Jeff Jarrett, the Intercontinental title. You've pinned those two on me for years. Well, I'm telling you right now, you're an anti-Archite. I've seen it in your eyes. I've heard it in the tone of your voice. All the Archie fans that listen to our podcast out there.
Yeah, all the Archie fans who have complained about my comments about Archie. All of them.
Yep. Well, I hope you're happy. You're going to have to face them one day.
Yep, I'll have to face the non-existent Legion of Archie.
There it goes again. Non-existent. Anti-Archism in its finest.
Fair enough.
In any event, let's move on to the... you know what your problem is, Nick? You suffer from
Negative world view. That's true. I do.
There are good people in the world. Don't say it. Mm. We've got the video games.
Like you. Wait. You skipped one. You skipped the only one of the four titles that we're actually interested in. You skipped Weapon X.
Oh, I thought we did that last time.
No.
Oh, yes. Well, tell the people about Weapon X.
Weapon X is a title, another team title coming from writer Greg Pak and artist Greg Land, and features a team of... Now, this is up my alley a little bit. The team of Old Man Logan, Sabretooth, Lady Deathstrike, Domino, and Warpath as they work to take down a resurrected Weapon X program that is aiming to exterminate mutants.
Sounds great.
This sounds awesome. Of all the X-Men titles, the main blue and gold books included, this is the one that I am most likely to check out. If only for the Old Man Logan inclusion, but just the general premise sounds
pretty
cool.
Old Man Logan and Sabretooth working together sounds really intriguing, does it not?
And we've already gotten a little preview of the Old Man Logan Deathstrike dynamic in the pages of Old Man Logan, And if Greg Pak writes it anything like Jeff Lemire, it should be a very entertaining dynamic for this book to be.
And that's my one hesitation, because unlike a lot of folks out there, I'm not super high on Greg Pak. I've never been a huge fan of his. I think he's a little overrated in my opinion, but he's not bad. And he has written some good things. And so I am excited about this. I think the premise is great. I think the cast is great. Why not give it a shot, right?
Absolutely.
Now, on the video game front, we got two big Marvel video game announcements. We're going to start with the one that we're not qualified to talk about at all.
Nope.
Marvel versus Capcom 4, which is, I believe, going to be known as Marvel versus Capcom Infinite, has been announced, and the trailer has come out, and it's coming out. I believe next year, a 2017 release for all the major consoles, presumably. It's going to be – more details will be available at the PlayStation Experience, or actually already has been announced at the PlayStation Experience. But in any event, it's continuing the classic Marvel vs. Capcom series of fighting games. Trailer looked great. Nick and I probably won't play it because we suck at fighting games.
That's true. Yep. The only fighting games we usually reach out for are the Injustice games, which are just because of our overwhelming DC fandom. One thing that I'm reading here on Polygon, a video game reporting website, is that the game will be released sometime in late 2017, and that in a break from the traditional format of the series, it will feature 2-versus-2 battles rather than 3-versus-3. I'd also read some rumors going around that this would be another example of Marvel de-emphasizing X-Men characters, but apparently another report came out that said that was not true. X-Men characters and Fantastic Four characters would very much be included in the playable roster
for
this. So.
Good deal.
Hopefully a fighting game version of Propeller Arms is on the way.
I'm sure that all the kids at the arcade will be picking Mr. Fantastic in this one.
If it's Propeller Arms, how can you blame
me? That's true. I will say, that's one element of these games that has always lost me, is I'm bad enough at regular fighting games, but the tag team format, I've never been able to figure it out. Like how to do the moves and everything, it's very hard for me. But in any event, this is going to be a huge seller. Hugely popular fighting game series, maybe the most popular fighting game series at this point, other than Street Fighter. So, kudos.
Yeah, Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat, I think would still be
kudos to the team behind that one. And then the news that tickles my fancy, the Guardians. I'm assuming lining up with the release of the movie next year, Guardians of the Galaxy is getting a Telltale Games treatment. And they actually have released the first trailer for it, teaser trailer. Not a lot.
Yeah, a little teaser.
Not seen in it, per se, but looks to capture the feel of Guardians, the movie. Looks to be heavily based on the movie rather than the comics, per se.
Right, and that's one thing I'm wondering is, I mean, you can't really draw too many conclusions based on a teaser trailer, but it certainly would seem as if this might be set in the Marvel Cinematic Universe rather than the comics.
That is the feel that I get from it. Now, I haven't read the
Or more likely, it's probably something like Batman, the Telltale series, where it's its own standalone universe that doesn't really have its ties to either.
Right, I could see that being the case, especially since the personal choice plays such a factor in these games. That would make more sense probably than having it.
And I think that's my biggest question. With this being a Guardians game, how will the personal choice factor work in a team dynamic? Are you going to play as just one of the Guardians, or will you assume... You know, the reigns of various Guardians.
I read an interview with the producers of this, and they say, players will take on multiple roles within the ragtag band of heroes and take the pilot seat in directing their escapades across the universe. It's going to be really interesting. I think this is why I'm so excited about this, Nick, because it's going to be Telltale doing something different, doing something challenging that they've never done before, and I'm really excited to see what they do with it.
My number one hope for this is that during a portion of the game, you get to play as Groot, and all of the dialogue options are variations on "I am Groot" with different punctuations and emphasis, and you have no clue what they
actually
mean.
You have no clue what
it's saying.
You have to rely on Rocket.
You have to blindly pick one.
And you have to rely on Rocket's translation, which you don't even know if Rocket is translating what you said correctly. Yep.
Yes, that is my biggest hope for this game, and I'm not even joking about that.
That's awesome. I love that. And speaking of Guardians... We also got the drop of a new trailer this week, an even better trailer, in my opinion.
A full-length non-teaser
trailer. Full-length trailer for Guardians 2, Volume 2, I should say. Loved it. Mm-hmm. Absolutely loved
it. Oh, my God. It was great. And it was absolutely –
including the introduction of one of the most important characters from the Dan Abnett, Andy Lanning Guardians run, which is Mantis, who was a big part of the Guardians team that they assembled. And she plays a prominent role in this one. And, of course – I mean, come on, Nick. We got it. We got to cross over at least in this one chance. Our boy, Big Dave.
Big Dave. Big Dave. Knocking it out of the park with the humor.
Absolutely. Oh,
between the teaser trailer that was previous released and this one, Big Dave is bringing the comedy shot.
He's primed to steal the show again.
Yep. Between he and Baby Groot, I think there's going to be a lot of fighting over who gets to steal the most suits. Yeah.
Very good. No, it was excellent. Looks awesome. Can't wait. There also appeared to be a giant space squid a la Watchmen, which I'm very excited about. So this looked awesome. Can't wait for this to hit theaters.
And we still haven't seen a single bit of Ego. Unless you were at San Diego Comic-Con last year, still no Ego in any of these trailers. So this is the rare example of a marketing campaign that isn't revealing
everything there is about the freaking movie. Thank you, DC. Please take notes. Very, very good. Very excited about this. So Guardians looks awesome. One last bit of news, and then we'll go to break and come back to talk about Iron Man 2. And this last bit of news is January's Batman number 14 and 15 have been changed from the end of the I Am Suicide arc into a two-issue story arc dealing with Batman deciding, quote, what to do with Catwoman after recent events. It'll be a two-part Catwoman story called Rooftops by Tom King and guest artist Mitch Gerards, who is works with Tom King on Sheriff of Babylon. And hey, as somebody who is an admitted Bat-Cat shipper, I am all for this. They can, in fact, the artist even talked about how romance books are his thing. So this is going to be a romance story arc. It's been a long time since we've got anything like that in a Batman comic. I'm all for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I am a little bit concerned that this may be the end for now of this dynamic.
Yep, I'm concerned about that as well, Nick. As you know, the only reason I started pulling the book again was because of this dynamic. So I'm giving them my dollars. I'm giving them my attention. Let's hope they reward it by giving me what I want. But we'll see.
Yeah, I'll also be interested to see if this just means that they're wrapping up the I Am Suicide story an issue earlier, or bizarrely making you wait for the ending of this, the ending of that story, while they do a little two-parter in the middle. Which I don't think they would do. I would imagine ending early is probably.
I do hope at some point Bane puts on some pants, for God's sake. I mean, listen, I understand he has his own private island, but does he have no shame?
You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with a half-naked Santa Priskin, for God's sake.
How could you miss him? Anyway, and that's the end of the rundown. We have nada. We have nothing left for you on the rundown. That's right. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back on the other side, after you hear about all the other great podcasts right here at Place to Be Nation, Place to Be Nation Pop, etc., we're going to come back on the other side and talk about
2009? 10.
Iron Man?
10, I believe.
Iron Man 2?
Pretty sure it's 10.
Yes,
it would have to be 10 because
yep, 10,
Avengers
right.
was 2012 yep. and both Thor and Captain yep. America were 2011. That's right.
Iron Man 2, 2010. So as you can tell, we're super prepared for this. We're going to talk about this film right after this. Stay with us, folks.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And, of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Explanations, JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaySimulation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the PlaySimulation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous vintage wall pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular PlaySimulation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows, plus others, available at PlaySimulation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaySimulation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaySimulation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name. Now it will be known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
Tony Stark makes you feel he's a cool exec with a heart of steel.
And Iron Man, all jets ablaze, he fights and fights with his ultra rays. Amazing armor.
Welcome back, Place to Be Nation. You should invest in better commercial breaks. This one gave with just one shove.
Ah, yes. Watchmen Rorschach, the gift that keeps on giving all these years later.
And will by the way, spoiler alert for those of you who listen to our show now, will continue giving every week from henceforth. And
you may sometimes you may think to yourself, would the show be better without all the Watchmen Rorschach references? And the answer, of course, is no. Fine like this.
Indeed. And sometimes during the show, when we help self to some beans, you'll be able to tell that, too.
I see what you're driving
That's
at.
That's right. With all that being said, it's time for the third installment of Hard Travelers for Hire, our episode by or movie by movie look at the Marvel Cinematic Universe by listener request, by the way, this particular feature. And we're entering into an interesting time now in the MCU in our timeline. We've already been through the first wave of movies, the wildly successful Iron Man and the successful, although not wildly successful, Incredible Hulk. And nothing.
This is really the first movie Iron Man 2 is that is a response to Marvel's success with Iron Man.
Because they didn't do anything. They took the year 2009 off, so to speak, from actual releases. And they come back with a $200 million budget for Iron Man 2, the sequel, the first sequel to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And in some ways, you could argue, you know, not as important as the first Iron Man, but still a really important film for a just being established movie division that was still on good ground with Iron Man and Incredible Hulk, but really they needed to be further established by having a good movie and having something that people would react to.
And it was the first movie that was more concerned with expanding the universe, introducing side characters and introducing, you know, subplots that would play off in later films rather than being interested in being mostly self-contained the way Iron Man and the Incredible Hulk were. You know, those both had exterior references to a certain degree, but this was the first one, and Jon Favreau talked about this in interviews, the challenge of trying to both tell his story and set up plot threads for other stories along the way.
Mm-hmm. And we're about ready. We're as always with these features, we're going to have the movie on in the background while we talk about it, not necessarily giving a blow-by-blow of what we're seeing, but we're going to be using it to remind ourselves of things and kind of guide the conversation if we have any lulls. And Wait a minute. I'm just getting an update. The Ho-Ho Loon ticker is back. Ladies and gentlemen, breaking news since last week. Ho-Ho Loon has been spotted on the WWE Network in the WWE Cruiserweight Show 205 Live. Ho-Ho Loon is back. Our nation turns its lonely eyes to you, Ho-Ho. Keep trucking
the
out.
The ho-hopes of a nation have risen once more.
That's right. That has been the Ho-Ho Loon update for the week. Anyway, so we're getting into a really interesting time in the MCU here. In the intervening years, since Iron Man 1 had come out, or just Iron Man, if you will, Robert Downey Jr.'s star had risen. I mean, he was back on top of the world. He followed Iron Man up just a few months later with another hugely successful film in a totally different vein, Tropic Thunder, where he was outstanding in that one. And then 2009...
A controversial skin pigmentation procedure.
Yes. What do you mean, you people? And then in 2009, of course, we got Sherlock Holmes, a very successful reboot of the Sherlock franchise. So he's riding high right now, heading into Iron Man 2. He has all the leverage in the world and has really become an A-lister after many years of being on the B and C list. So he's riding high. Jon Favreau is riding high, although dealing with the weight of expectations in this film and also dealing with the same kind of struggles that Joss Whedon would go through years later, trying to balance several different threads in one film. But we're about ready to start the movie. We've both got it at 000 on our Blu-ray editions, and we are going to – are you ready, Nick?
I'm ready.
We are going to hit play in 3, 2, 1, play. And so going into this one, it's Jon Favreau directing again. All the major players are back from the first Iron Man movie, with one major exception that we will get to here, I'm sure, in just a few minutes. But the Tony Stark, Robert Downey Jr., he's back. Gwyneth Paltrow is back as Pepper Potts. The love.
Jon Favreau is Happy Hogan.
Competitor. Jon Favreau is Happy Hogan. The interestingly named Happy Hogan. And Samuel L. Jackson as Nick Fury, who popped up in the post credits of the first one, and has some great lines in this one, as you'll encounter during the course of the film. So Nick, what do you remember about the build-up for this movie in particular?
Honestly, it was the intrigue over the casting decisions. You know, as we'll discuss, Mickey Rourke coming on board was, you know, very highly publicized coming off of The Wrestler. So, you and I were both more excited than most to see him take on a villainous role in the franchise. And then also, of course, as you alluded to a moment ago, the big, I don't know if I want to call it a controversy, but the hubbub, so to speak, over Terrence Howard being replaced as James Rhodes by Don Cheadle was something of a story as well.
Yes, and again, for those that aren't familiar, we went over this in the Iron Man podcast, so we're not going to belabor the point, but Iron Man is an interesting character to look at right now, because as we exist in 2016, Iron Man is indisputably an A-list character.
Yep.
But before the movie Iron Man, he was not. And in the comics, while there have certainly been memorable Iron Man stories over the years, frankly, I haven't read many. And he doesn't have a big rogues gallery of memorable.
I mean, the ones that when most people would, you know, instantly point to would, of course, be Demon in a Bottle, Armor Wars, and probably Extremis. Those would probably be the three, you know, that draw the most attention. And while I think they could probably get away with doing some version of it, I think we can all agree that it's highly unlikely we're ever going to get anything that takes Demon in a Bottle to the degree that the comics do. Mm-hmm. There are hints of it in this mm-hmm. film, but it's always treated as more of, you know, the joke than the depressing side of alcoholism that they get into in Demon in a Bottle.
Right, right. And to be honest, some of the themes that are explored in Iron Man 3 are probably closer to the things they explored in Demon in a Bottle than the ones in this film.
Yes.
So, in any event, there aren't a lot of great Iron Man stories to draw from. So, in this one, we get kind of a mishmash of some other Iron Man stories from the past. We get a as you're seeing right now on screen, Mickey Rourke's character of Ivan Vanko, as he is building his version of the arc reactor, essentially, where he's going to have these whip-like tendrils that he will
use.
Yeah,
he's going to be playing a version of the Iron Man villain Whiplash, essentially.
Right, and it turns out to be sort of an amalgam between Whiplash and a character called the Crimson Dynamo that I don't know right. a whole lot about, but...
You should love the Crimson Dynamo, because much like Omega Red, one of his, you know, biggest defining characteristics that he speaks in Russian stereotypes.
Ah, Oliver! Have a drink, yes?
Yes.
Very good. Anyway, so we have Mickey Rourke playing a Russian guy, which is kind of interesting. As we saw his father die earlier, now we see his prized bird drinking from his goblet.
And you kind of see, you know, what his apartment looks like. It's clear that this family has something of a stark obsession, I think.
Yes, and it's clear also that this family is very well off, given the standard set by Adrian Vett in Watchmen Rorschach.
Absolutely.
So, one of the aspects that people were interested in about this movie is, would it be able to maintain the overall feel of the first one, which was so different from any superhero movie that had really come before it? The humor, the snarkiness, the sarcasm, the lighthearted nature of it, but mixed with some good action and stuff like that. But that is kind of addressed right off the bat in a scene that you're about to see right now. This is sort of our first big scene in the film where we're going to see Iron Man skydiving out of a plane to go to the Stark Expo, cracking one-liners the whole way. Instantly, you know that this is definitely the style of Iron Man films. This is what you can expect when you go to the theater to see an Iron Man film. And it kind of, in many ways, I think, set the guideline for what we could expect from the MCU going forward.
Yeah, I would agree to a certain extent. You know, as we'll discuss going forward, one of the things the first Iron Man did so expertly, in my opinion, was it had that perfect blend of heart, humor, and action. And to me, the Iron Man solo movies have never quite hit that balance quite as well as the first one did. This one, you know, certainly has its humorous moments. It's still got a lot of humor. It's still got a lot of action. But I thought it, you know, skewed a little bit more towards the dramatic side at times than the first or the third did. And then, of course, when we reach the third one, we'll talk about how I felt like it skewed almost entirely towards the comedic side of things. But that's a discussion far, far down the road.
Right, and we'll get to my thoughts on that a little bit later on as we get into our divide on this film, I think. I will say this, after just rewatching it a few minutes before we finished or before we started this podcast, I'm even more entrenched in my thoughts on this one. I will get to that near the end of the film. But anyway, we see here the Stark Expo as raging egomaniac Tony Stark is has a team of cheerleaders in Iron Man attire cheering for him with a giant American flag in the background.
Listen, when you have the means, I mean, why not? You know? Why not? There are worse things to do with money and time than what he's doing right
now.
That's
true. That's a good point. There are a lot... By the way, there are a lot of people there. Like, I don't think I realized that when I was watching it earlier. There is a... For it to be a technology expo, that is an abnormal amount of people.
Well, I think the idea... the idea, given the massive, like, the way the architectural layouts play into it, later in the film. I think the idea is for the Stark Expo to be a stand-in for some of the, like, kind of like a World's Fair.
Yeah. That's a good point.
You know, the latter day, where it's more than just a technical expo. It's really intended to be this massive gathering and this showcase, you know, to the world, essentially, of American ingenuity.
Wow, that was really good. You would think that you work for a big corporation or something, the way you talk.
In any event, I also love, you know, you were speaking about the egomaniacal nature of Tony and calling himself the greatest Phoenix metaphor of all time is something of a nice
Yes,
touch.
That's very good. There's a lot of – I don't know – I didn't know who wrote the script for this. Apparently, Justin Theroux wrote it, and there are a ton of brilliant one-liners in this that I noticed this last get through. We're going to get one here in just a few, and I'll mention it when it gets to it. But so this is a film that basically centers around Tony dealing with the fact that he's dying. The ore that he has used, or the element that he has used to power
palladium.
Palladium is the element that he's used to power his arc reactor. Is killing him, basically. The more he relies upon it, the more it is killing him, which is a trope that we see in superhero properties a lot more today, I would argue, because it was pretty novel at that time, at least in outside comics media. So, pretty interesting storyline. Tony is kind of dealing with his own mortality, and how do you deal with it when you know that you're on a ticking timeline and you have no hope to survive it? And Tony doesn't deal with it in the best way, you could argue. He deals with it through booze and throwing elaborate parties and basically alienating the people that are closest to him because he won't tell them the truth of what's happening. And here you also see an interesting recast, is it not, of Howard Stark? Or was it a recast? I can't remember from the first one.
I don't remember. Did they show Howard Stark in the
first one? I don't remember, to be honest. But I do remember there was some level...
John Slattery has played Elder Howard Stark in every appearance since this. I believe he was the only individual to play the Elder Howard Stark. Now, of course, you have Dominic Cooper, who plays the younger Howard Stark in, you know, Captain America the First Avenger and the various television properties that have spun out of that. But I'm pretty sure John Slattery
was... it's interesting because I think... I think you're right about that. It's interesting because in many cases they would just go with... de-aging the actor or aging the actor up. And there's Stan Lee as Larry King, which is a great touch, a perfect bit of casting. But anyway, a lot of times they would go with, you know, they just use technology to de-age or age up the actor, and instead they had two different actors to play the same role, which is kind of...
That was kind of a weird sequence, just then going first person.
Yeah, that was very odd. I didn't understand that. Here comes one of the first great one-liners of the film from Jon Favreau's Happy Hogan. There's somebody serving. There's a young lady serving Tony a subpoena. He's ordered to appear before the Senate Armed Forces Committee. Can I see a badge? You want to see the badge? And then Happy Hogan, he likes the badge, which is a good line. And then they head off to D.C. So I appreciated that.
Who is that actress?
I have no idea.
I want to say that's Kate Mara.
Who?
Hold on. Give me a moment. I'm
Gary Shandling as the condescending senator makes
Yeah, Gary Shandling is pretty
here.
Great.
Amazing. Going back and forth with Tony Stark, who just has his number, quite frankly. But the Shandling is so condescending here. It's great. Likes
off topic, but funnily enough, the Wikipedia article for Iron Man 2 suggests that we see also a list of films featuring powered exoskeletons, which I didn't know there was such a list.
It's a long-standing technological idea, quite frankly.
Good Lord, there are a lot more than you would think. But I'm way off case, way off topic at this point.
So Tony is basically just turning this Senate meeting into a clown show. The other subplot of this film the other main plot of this film is, in addition to Ivan Vanko, in addition to Tony dying, the U.S. government is seeking to weaponize the Iron Man suit. They view it as a dangerous weapon that's in the hands of a drunken idiot that they don't trust to use that power. So they want to get a hold of Stark's technology and use it for the U.S. military to protect the country, or so they say. And here is my favorite character in the film, Sam Rockwell as Justin Hammer. And if you remember, Nick, when this movie was announced, I thought the name Justin Hammer was so ridiculous there'd be no way they'd be able to pull it off on screen. I forgot all about that about 5 minutes into this, because this guy is awesome.
That's one thing that we'll have to resurrect from our Iron Man podcast. For someone who is such a Superman fan where all the names are alliterative L's, you have a huge issue with the Iron Man name.
I really do. Hammer Industries. Good God. Makes it sound like MC Hammer started his own technological institute.
But Lex Luthor and Lana Lang and Lois
Lane. Sure, people could be named that. Who do you know? Who do you know with the last name Hammer? Army Hammer? Okay, very good.
I would suggest that I don't know enough people with the last name Hammer.
Armand Hammer. Armin Hammer, yes. Anyway, but that guy, suffice it to say, Sam Rockwell kills it in this movie. I love him. I can't believe they haven't used him in any of the other movies. It honestly frustrates me because Marvel is so lacking good villains. And you don't have to be a physical threat to be a good villain. This guy is so much more interesting than all of the Obadiah Stane knockoffs that they've had in these movies since then.
That was something of an interesting not to interrupt, but Don Cheadle just walked on screen for the first time, and I feel like his line was somewhat meta in a sense, because he said, "I'm here, it's me, let's move on.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I remember laughing in the theater, the recasting happened, let's move past it.
And we'll touch on that recasting in just a minute. I think that we both have a take on it that doesn't sit well with one of our mutual friends, but we'll get to that in a minute.
He should be happy that it all worked out, because now he can watch his favorite actor take his company back each and every week on Fox.
Oh, but will he take it with just one shove? Oh, God. Mm. Anyway, we'll get to that. But in any event, Justin Hammer is a character I thought I would not find compelling. I was like, and honestly, I thought, oh, another evil businessman. He's going to be boring. This guy is tremendous because they play him completely for laughs pretty much, because he's just
he is somebody who so desperately wants to be Tony Stark but doesn't know how.
He's almost obsessed with it. He wants to be the cool guy in the room, but you can tell he's never been the cool guy in any room that he's walked in.
He isn't nearly as smart as Tony, and he isn't nearly as cool as Tony, but that doesn't stop him from trying desperately to be both of those
things.
Yes. And failing miserably.
There's a great scene later in the movie when he holds his own expo, his own demonstration, and he tries to copy Tony from the beginning of the movie by dancing, and he dances his way up there, and no one reacts to it. Yep. There's like a smattering of applause in the audience.
And then he makes a joke that clearly was intended to draw applause so that his podium could be whisked away during the applause, but yet it's awkwardly quiet, and so he just kind of stands there as the girls come up and take the podium away.
He's so good, man. Like, I became a big Sam Rockwell fan in subsequent years for some of the other movies that he's done. I think he is way undervalued in Hollywood. He's really good in general. He is great in this movie. Love him. Wish they'd bring him back for if they ever do another Iron Man movie, or even if they wanted to bring him in one of the other movies in a bit role.
That's one thing. I mean, as we'll discuss next month when we get to Thor, Loki is a character they've shown a willingness to bring back, but they have left other villains kind of dangling out there and the possibility to have recurring villains and haven't really pulled the trigger on any of them yet.
Even if they had Hammer called in to, like, brief the Avengers on something because he's considered an expert on something even though he's really not, that would have been cool just to see him and Tony interact again, because that's the other thing. Rockwell is not afraid to be made the butt of a scene, and Robert Downey Jr. makes him the butt of the scene a lot of times in this movie, which is super entertaining. Shanling with the dreaded FU to Stark at a senatorial hearing, which would be delightful in real life. So, Yeah, so we might as well go ahead and get into it. The recasting of James Rhodes, who plays a huge factor in this movie, plays into the main action set pieces at the end. I'll go ahead and say it. I think he's a step up from Terrence Howard, personally, as Rhodey anyway.
Yes, as Rhodey. I very much have enjoyed Terrence Howard in certain roles, but this seems to work a bit better. He seems to have a better chemistry with RDJ, and just kind of, and it's strange because Terrence Howard is a larger man than Don Cheadle, and yet Don Cheadle seems to have more of a physical presence on screen as Rhodes.
He carries carries himself more like a military officer than Terrence Howard ever did, and he also has more of a natural comedic timing, I think, than Howard had, and so he plays off of RDJ really well. And they seem to improv. And based on what I read about Iron Man 3, they do improv a lot of their lines together. And so it really shows off on screen. And so I think it was a good recast. It was a rare example of a good recasting that works out for the better and has made all of the Marvel movies better. I think that he...
And there's another recurring character of the stupid robot from the first
one. The stupid robot is back. Jarvis is back, mocking Tony and talking about...
Voiced by Paul Bettany in excellent fashion.
Yes, kind of mocking Tony along the way with some of his exploits. And here we see the kind of the first real shot of Tony struggling to survive, basically. The toxicity in his blood is increasing. His attempts to find new elements for the core have failed miserably. And it's not looking good for Tony. He's starting to prepare himself. He knows what's coming. And how that kind of factors into this movie, we'll see later on. It actually is what brings in S.H.I.E.L.D. Samuel L. Jackson as Nick Fury, another character who makes her debut here in just a little bit. So, yeah. Oh, and there's Gwyneth Paltrow making her first appearance as Pepper Potts. Huge part of these movies. I think an irreplaceable part of this franchise. She has she deserves all the credit in the world for carrying her into these movies and really, again, having a very good relationship with RDJ in these movies, because Tony Stark is a character who needs people around him to call him on his shit, and she is the one character in these movies, along with Rhodey, but she and Rhodey are not afraid at all to call Tony on his shit. So
one of the aspects that I think they actually improved on from Iron Man 1 to Iron Man 2 is, you know, we discussed in our review of the first Iron Man that I felt like at times she would be phoning it in a little bit. Not the case here in the second one. I think she actually stepped her performance a great deal.
I think they gave her more to do, too.
You think what?
I think they gave her more to do, too.
More to do, and I think she realized that this was something that had legs and wasn't just a joke one-off that she had gotten roped into. I think she realized that this meant a lot to people and resonated with people in a big way. So I think it caused her to bring her A-game.
Tony putting down a piece of real art to put up an Iron Man poster in his own room. That's pretty nice there. Great touch. And we also this movie also really amps up the the quote-unquote Iron Man technology scenes. In other words, where Tony is walking through his lab and there's just random, like, light structures everywhere that he's moving to and fro, back and forth, all around. You see that several times in the film. I'm assuming that's where a vast majority of the budget goes. That and the suits, of course.
Sorry, I got sucked into watching the scene there. But yeah, it's kind of a pivotal scene here as they as Tony is turning over the CEO duties and CEO powers of Stark Industries to Pepper Potts, which is a storyline that will factor heavily into this film and Iron Man 3 as well.
One thing that we forgot to mention, the end of Iron Man, as we mentioned in that podcast, had him make the shocking move of revealing his secret identity, which was a big deal
publicly,
at the time.
Yes.
This movie is also dealing with the fallout of that. That's how the government is involved. The government now knows that Tony Stark, the crazy industrialist, and they're coming after him for it. But now he's on the radar. He's been approached by Nick Fury and turned him down for the Avengers initiative. You know, Tony is starting to this is the movie where you see Tony start to deal with some of the ramifications of a few of the decisions he made in Iron Man 1. So it is a true sequel in that way, in addition to being a standalone story. It's really picking up on a lot of the threads that were established in the first one.
One thing that was revealed in the director's commentary for this, and I believe one of the featurettes actually as well, is that that individual that right here on screen that Vanko just met with is actually in the script supposed to be a member of the Ten Rings, which is to give you the impression that they are still out there and being active. Although I would argue that doesn't exactly jive with where the franchise would go in Iron Man 3, of course.
I would also argue that there was nothing in that scene to indicate that.
Yes, I agree with that, but apparently, you know, what I'm saying is director commentary, script, that was the intention at first, and for whatever reason it was not translated onto the screen.
Tony blatantly cheating in his sparring session with Happy Hogan.
I don't know that he blatantly cheated.
He threw an elbow!
Well, you know, he's the boss. He gets the good
Lord have mercy.
Now it's time for the little Richard hands. Woo!
Oh my God! Yeah. The other new addition to the cast in this film,
such as she is,
sweet Jesus, Scarlett Johansson as what is her fake name in this? Natalie Rushman.
Natalie Rushman, yes.
A.K.A. Natasha Romanoff, the Black Widow.
A.K.A. the Black Widow, yes.
And we don't mean to turn into meat
as slobbering chauvinist pigs.
Chauvinist pigs here, but I mean, to be completely honest, she is absolutely stunning in this movie. I mean, not that she's never not stunning,
but
she is. I mean, particularly stunning in this movie. And here, Tony is basically trying to convince Pepper to allow him to hire her, even though he's not aware of her qualifications yet.
And she wasn't even supposed to be the Black Widow originally, is the crazy part of this.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yes, if I'm not mistaken. Let me, I'm trying to remember the actress's name, but...
They made the right choice.
No, I absolutely agree, but some sort of scheduling conflict, you know, worked out. God, I can't remember who it was. Give me a minute while I look that up.
No problem. I'll take over here. Happy Hogan has sadly become Sad Hogan right now, as he has been taken down by the Black Widow and embarrassed in front of his boss, although nobody knows that she's a government agent. They think she's just applying for a job and attempting to seduce Tony Stark to do so. She's blatantly flirting with him, and he's flirting with her, and that's how Tony works. So, of course, it works on him, and she gets the job with Stark Industries as Tony's assistant. Pepper, a little jealous, perhaps, who knows, but Tony has a way of getting himself in weird situations. Another great line, "I want one," from Tony, and she quickly says no.
Emily Blunt was originally cast as Black Widow, but had to pull out due to scheduling conflicts.
Oh, wow.
That was,
Emily Blunt's good. She's a good actress, but they made the right choice.
No, I would certainly...
I like Emily Blunt,
I would certainly
That would have been interesting. She's good.
It would have been very, very interesting. Although I'm certainly not going to complain about the way things...
No, it worked out well. And in addition to our obvious aesthetic... commentary a moment ago, in all seriousness, she did a great job in this movie.
She really did, yes.
If you're a comic book fan, you know who she is, you know what's coming, or at least you have an idea of it. For people that weren't comic book fans, like my parents, when they saw this, they were caught off guard by that. They didn't see it coming, that she was a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent and all that. So, really cool. She does a great job of playing innocent around Tony, and then, as you'll see later in the film, when it's time to turn up the badassery, she has... I would say probably my favorite action scene in the whole movie.
I don't know that I got quite that far, but she has a hell of an action
scene. It's a great action scene. It's up there in my favorite scene. There's
Elon Musk with a cameo here.
Who?
Elon Musk, a prominent scientist and inventor in real life.
Oh, wow. And there's Justin Hammer again. I love this scene so much. I just love it. Hammer comes up there. He's trying to, you know, again, it's a pissing contest between Tony and Justin Hammer as they're trying to.
And one that Hammer is woefully
unequipped for. Yes.
Yes.
And, you know, he's got this reporter working on a feature about him. And the instant that she notices that Tony's there, she's interested. Another great line coming up here, a one-liner that's easy to forget. They're talking about, she did quite a spread on Tony last year. And then Tony goes, and she wrote a story, too.
Yeah, she is reprising her role as Christine Everhart, the Vanity Fair reporter who slept with Tony in the opening scene.
I didn't even remember her
first Iron Man film. And then also confronted him later on about the tragedy in Gulmira that spurs him into the first real big action set piece of the Iron Man film, if you remember. If that's jogging your memory now at all.
Mm-hmm.
Pepper Potts kicks her out
gotcha.
In the morning, has the good line about taking out the trash and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So she comes back here. And folks, we apologize. We had a little bit of technical difficulty, so we're actually jumping ahead due to time constraints in your viewing experience. And now we have kind of moved ahead into the what I'd argue is one of the best action set pieces of this film, which is first the race sequence where Tony Stark irresponsibly takes over control of a Grand Prix car and drives in the Grand Prix of Monaco, and that race is interrupted by Vanko as Whiplash, and here. You know, he is just, you know, taken out Tony's car, shown off his adamantium pelvis by having it rammed several times, you know, in between Happy Hogan's car and a barrier of concrete, and yet showing no ill effects in the genitalia area, which is rather impressive, in my opinion. So, you know, all in all, a kind of an impressive showing for Vanko here, and, you know, ladies should be interesting.
We are at 36:37 right now. 36:37 on the film. For those of you trying to catch up to our viewing experience, and Tony just judo tossed Vanko, and we haven't mentioned, by the way, another rare instance of a crossover between our two loves. Jim Ross's favorite character in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Whiplash.
Whiplash, yeah, that's true. So yeah, you know, a good action set
just spit blood. Yeah.
A good action set piece there, and I would say to this point in the film, everything has been going extremely well. I did enjoy the first time I saw it, and still on recent rewatches, including one just before we started this podcast, you know, everything up to this point has been going swimmingly, as they say.
I'm a little perturbed they never do reveal who won the race. As Justin Hammer suddenly gets a look of sexual satisfaction on his face, he's seen somebody one-up Tony Stark.
And here's the first scene of the movie that I have something of an issue with.
Tell me why.
I think you'll probably know why, but this movie exists in a post-Dark Knight world. And does this scene not smack to you of, like, trying desperately to recreate that Joker and Batman interrogation scene from The Dark Knight? Because it does to me, and it doesn't come off nearly as well, right down to, like, you know, Vanko delivering lines that are supposed to be, like, cryptic and metaphorical, and yet they just come off as kind of cheesy, in my opinion, about sharks with blood in the water and all this other crap.
I'll be completely honest with you, Nick. That never crossed my mind any of the times.
Oh,
I've
come on, dude! They're walking down the highway and he's like, "No name, no prince." It comes straight out of The Dark Knight.
I mean, if you view it through that prism, I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm saying it's never crossed my mind ever watching it. Again, not saying that you're wrong. Not saying that it's not a valid way of looking at things, but I've never thought of it in that light. Maybe because it's different in many ways. I mean, this isn't Vanko isn't playing games with Stark in this scene the way that Joker was playing games with Batman in that.
Oh,
scene.
I disagree. He's very much playing games with him. Like, I mean, it's clear that all he wants to do now is verbally and emotionally torture him. That he is going to sit here and watch him, you know.
But there's no. This is the end of his plan at this point.
That's
at
true.
This point, this is Vanko's plan. It's done. He's going to a cell. That was just the interrogation scene was really just the beginning of Joker's plan.
That's true.
I mean, Joker was playing chess on a level far beyond what Vanko's playing here.
But in any event, this line here about making God bleed and people ceasing to – it just – I don't know. For a movie franchise that almost always excels at dialogue, this is the first time where I kind of started to roll my eyes a little bit.
I like this scene. I didn't have any issues with it. It's not the dark – if you're comparing it to the Dark Knight –
I'm not comparing it to the Dark Knight. I'm comparing it to, you know, to well-written dialogue.
No, I like it. I think it's perfectly in place in a superhero movie. I mean, it's no worse than something. Then we're Ironmongers, Tony. Come on.
That's your one.
This is your one. They're Ironmongers.
No, I have more. We haven't gotten here yet. We haven't gotten to them yet.
Yeah, that's fine. I had my ones in Iron Man. You have your ones in Iron Man too, but why does he have a grill? Have we ever established that?
Why
does he have silver teeth?
Understanding of it is that he was in prison a lot, did not get great dental care, and so that was the style at the time.
In Soviet Russia, teeth pull you.
Yes.
There's Shandling again.
Shandling. Every time Shandling appears in the MCU, the late, great Gary Shandling, it's a good thing. I'm sad we won't be having him around anymore.
Senator Stern. I wonder if that's a nod to longtime Avengers writer Roger Stern.
It could be. It could be. Here's Tony's poor attempt at cooking.
Yeah. What kind of omelet is he attempting to make there?
I believe it's a spinach omelet.
Sounds delicious.
It's not bad.
Yeah, it could be.
Why does it take him 3 hours to make eggs, by the way? Eggs take like 10 minutes.
Presumably, he had several failed attempts. And by several, I mean many, many, many failed attempts.
Yes.
At eggs.
Hundreds of
Although it does look like he overcooked it, so,
yeah,
you know. Now here is Pepper just won't shut up long enough for him to – no, that's later actually when that happens. Here, you know, she's trying to get the truth out of him about what's going on, and Tony's being evasive as always.
Indeed.
But
not really being that evasive, being rather obvious about the fact that something is clearly wrong, but he just doesn't want to come out and say it. Like, he's asking her to, like, take a leave of absence and all these other things. So it's like he's doing that thing where that people do sometimes when they post, like, vague Facebook statuses and they really want you to ask about what's going on. That's essentially what he's doing here, is the verbal equivalent of that.
Yeah. Yeah. That happens. With some regularity in some cases.
But that notwithstanding.
That notwithstanding, quite frankly. And now, my boy Justin Hammer is going to break Vanko out and bring him into his employ, which, quite frankly, I think Vanko was far, far too unappreciative of all of this during the course of the movie. I mean, at one point, Vanko kills Hammer's guards, fails to follow through on what he's been hired to do, which is build these drones and make them operable for the expo, circumvents it for his own personal want for revenge. I mean, why doesn't Vanko just accept the offer that's given to him by Justin Hammer, who goes through all this trouble to break him out?
Because Vanko clearly thinks that Hammer is an idiot and is going to use him for his own purposes, his own plan
now,
to get at Tony Stark.
An idiot is a strong word to use for Justin Hammer. How did Hammer acquire... Hey, let me ask you this. If he's so dumb, how come he's rich?
That's a great question. Some could ask... Never mind. I'm not even going to say that. We're not going to get political anymore. We're not going to do it. We're just going to move on. We're going to move right past it. So here's...
You were referring, of course, to President Lex, right?
President Lex, of course. So here's Vanko breaking out of the... breaking out of the jail, breaking that guy's neck here. Yep.
And that guy didn't last very long,
nope,
did he?
There's a little explosion. He brushes his shoulder off, of course.
All these guards look the same to me, by the way.
Well, they're...
Like they look like the same person.
Vaguely European.
Yes. Oh, there's the mask over him. Hey, I think that's Bennett!
I don't think that's
That guy looks
Bennett.
Like Bennett
not
on
Bennett.
The other side. It could be Bennett.
It's
don't
not
take that
Bennett, Greg.
Don't take that. Why do you have to take things from me, Nick?
I don't take them from you. I just state facts. And here's this bizarre all-white hanger that
love it.
Hammer just has on standby somewhere, by the way.
He's just different. He's just unique and eccentric and different from the bland Marvel Cinematic Universe villains that we've had in many of these films. Not all, many. Look at his stupid napkin thing that he's got tucked into his tucked into his shirt. I love it.
It is rather odd. It is rather odd, but.
But yes. Oh my God! What kind of shirt is that that Mickey Rourke is wearing?
It's a jail shirt of some kind that has a very deep V-neck.
V-neck, as if they want us to stare at Mickey Rourke's cleavage.
Well, you know, he didn't get tatted up for nothing.
Well, that's true. There's a lot of tattoos on him, and of course, this movie is also continuing. We haven't even talked about Mickey Rourke's career resurgence after The Wrestler, but in addition. This is something, especially for David Sunday, who is a celebrity hair expert. Mickey Rourke's hair became something of an entity unto itself.
Yeah, you would think that this was just a wig or something he was wearing for the movie, but no,
Oh, that's his hair.
That's just the look he went with at the time.
The entity known as Mickey Rourke's hair, as you'll see in other movies that he's done subsequently. Certainly a unique look, but who are we to judge?
It's not the bleach blonde wrestler look for sure.
No. So I guess we should get into actually analyzing the film instead of just describing what we're seeing. but let's talk about, I guess we always like to talk about the performances. What did you make of the performances in this one, Nick?
Well, we hit several other performances already. I mean, whether we talked about a little bit about Gwyneth Paltrow and how I think she kind of stepped up a little bit. Don Cheadle, who kind of fills the role a little bit better. We've talked about Rockwell. We've talked about Rourke. So I guess really what that leaves is RDJ. And I mean, what is there to say at this point about Robert Downey Jr.'s Tony Stark that hasn't already been said 100 times by people 100 times more qualified than you or I? I mean,
I think
it's iconic.
We actually voted him either number one or number two on our top performances at one point, I think, so if I'm not mistaken. Just an incredible match of character and actor.
Yeah, and not even really. I wouldn't even call it a match because, I mean, he so completely took the character.
Yeah.
And reinvented him, like, to the point now that the comic book version of Tony Stark is essentially just Robert Downey Jr.'s Tony Stark. Like, there.
Sure. This version of Tony Stark did not exist
before Robert Downey Jr.
No. He did for Tony Stark what Val Kilmer did for Doc Holliday.
Yes, very much so.
Which is changed. No matter what the historic version was like, it doesn't matter.
Yep.
Whatever previous versions were like, it doesn't matter. I have no idea if Doc Holliday talked like a Cajun guy, but in my mind, he sounds exactly like Val Kilmer in Tombstone. And that's the situation with Tony Stark now and Robert Downey Jr., how thoroughly he redefined it. So, yeah, I wanted to get your take, though, on Mickey Rourke. This has been a somewhat divisive performance over the years. A lot of people not a big fan of Whiplash as a villain. A lot of people not a big fan of this performance. What did you make of it?
It's okay. I think it's extremely over the top, but I believe that was the direction that was given. So you can't really fault the actor here. I think this is, for better or for worse, it is what it was intended to be. And I think in that vein, he gave an admirable performance, you know, translating what Favreau wanted onto screen. Now I have no factual basis for saying, you know, for blaming Favreau, so to speak, for some of the more ridiculous aspects of Vanko, but I just kind of get that vibe from it. Because if it's a series of choices, man, it is a series of choices in which Mickey Rourke is completely unrestrained by anybody else working on this film.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's okay because, again, I think Iron Man has such a corny list of villains that's why they're combining two of them and trying to make an interesting one out of it. You know, I think his performance was really good. I thought he stood out. I don't think the character is particularly great or compelling. That's kind of my one. You know, I like this movie a lot, but I think Vanko is kind of the one weak link in this movie for me. That it's not a terribly compelling character, but I think Mickey Rourke is so over the top entertaining that it draws me in when he's on screen. And it also does lead to some pretty good action scenes, as we'll see later in the film, mm-hmm. which is one aspect we'll have to talk about later, because I think one of the reasons for our divide is our differing focuses on stuff. Like, I'm much bigger on the importance of the action scenes, I think, than you are, and we'll get to that a little bit later on. But I think it was he did what he needed to do to make an otherwise uninteresting character seem more interesting. The problem for me is that in a rare instance in a superhero film, I found the non-physical threat villain to be much more interesting than the physical threat villain. And that doesn't happen a lot for me in superhero films, because I often think that the mortal villains are pretty bland and boring largely, because they tend to be out of that same generic mold. In this case, it's different, where every time Vanko's on, I just keep wanting Justin Hammer to appear. And here we see them together, actually, as Vanko is screwing around with Hammer's technology, and some would say exposing some flaws in Hammer's technology. I would say that that's, you know, not accurate.
Greg,
not
I understand that you like the character and the portrayal of the character and the performance, but the movie, they wrote him to be taken advantage of. You don't have to defend the character.
Well, quite frankly, I'd suggest that there are a lot of unfair things said about him in this movie, and
which are all proven clearly to be true by the end.
Clearly, he's earned his fortune somehow, has he not?
I have no idea.
I don't think that he just inherited his company from, I don't know, a wealthy father.
It's certainly possible. It would explain his Stark obsession.
Perhaps a Matthew Cornell Hammer?
Perhaps. I don't know why you pulled that name of all things.
Well, put the initials together and perhaps you'll find out, sir.
Oh, God.
Please, Hammer, don't hurt him. Oh, boy. I want to take a dump on Tony Stark's front lawn. That's what Hammer wants to do. Very good. We always appreciate a good dump, don't we, Nick?
Oh, especially those of the emergency variety.
That's right. And hey, Mike, wait a minute. I can't rewind the movie right now, but oh my God. I got distracted. I was about to say, I believe, maybe I'm wrong, Nick, but I think that Tony's nipples might have been erect there, a la Dr. Manhattan.
I couldn't get a good look. You know, they were mostly focused on the chest, the central chest area, rather than the nipple area. So the world may never know. Oh, God.
Wow. Folks, we're just completely useless every time the Black Widow is on screen right now. Mm. baseball.
Margaret Thatcher naked on a cold day.
Oh, good Lord.
Oh, so yeah, we got this little scene of some sort of tenderness between Tony Stark and Natalie Rushman. You know, certainly subsequent events in the film make you wonder if it was genuine at all or if she was just playing a role. I tend to believe she's just playing a role here.
Playing a role, yeah, definitely. She's an expert. As we see in a future installment of Hard Travelers for Hire, she's an expert at playing people, mm-hmm. playing on their emotions. So I think she's just playing a role here.
Yeah, and so here's what I was kind of referring to earlier. When
Drunk
I said
Tony.
That they kind of take some aspects of Demon in a Bottle where they're clearly attempting to show with this scene here that he is out of control, but they're almost playing it for laughs more than they are for true despair or a sense of danger. Now there is a little bit a sense of danger to the scene, you know, after a while, but really they're seeking to play it for comedy here more than anything else, which is not ultimately the point of Demon in a Bottle if you've ever delved into that.
Yeah, Pepper is not laughing, though.
No.
Neither is Rhodey.
No.
And you'll see here in
but
a few minutes.
But unfortunately, when you saw it in theaters, or the times that I've seen it in theaters, the audience is laughing.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, absolutely. No, and I laughed this time because
yes.
it was funny.
Yeah.
I mean, that's simply all there is to it. A drunk guy stumbling around in an Iron Man suit is kind of funny, as long as they're not hurting anybody. Now, in a minute, Tony's going to start putting people in danger. That's when things get out of hand. And this is when we get another cool action scene. And you know a big moment for me, Nick, because I'm a big War Machine fan. So this is just a good scene in general, I thought, at least in terms of setting the stage for this conflict. I will admit, on this most recent rewatch, I think Rhodey kind of skipped a few steps from, you know, maybe confronting Tony about being a drunk buffoon to stealing one of his suits and beating him up.
Well, you got to remember, though, Rhodey ultimately is a military man, and he's bound to follow orders. And he was just – the scene immediately preceding this, he was on the phone basically, you know, calling in a favor to keep from having to take Tony's suit by force. And here Tony is essentially proving himself unworthy of Rhodey's friendship and help in this situation.
Yeah. Tony trying to kiss her through the Iron Man mask was making me laugh, by the way. That was what I was chuckling at, not your response. That was good. I mean, that was a good explanation. I get that. But this is really cool. We're about to see the big Iron Man War Machine throwdown.
But is it really War Machine without all
really
the bells and whistles? It's just kind of James Rhodes in an early Iron Man suit.
In an early Iron Man suit, yeah. So it's really just that. We don't really see a fully formed War Machine until later in the film. Although when he shows up, it's awesome. When he has I remember in the theater how pumped up I was when he had the shoulder cannon for the first time, and he's firing off the wrist guns and the shoulder cannon shooting in a totally different direction. I was just in heaven, because when I was a kid, I never read Iron Man comics really a lot. I read a couple, and I never really liked them when I did read it, but I always liked War Machine. I always thought he was really cool and had a great, better-looking suit.
Yeah, War Machine, like, is a character that I know he wasn't created in the 90s, but it's almost like he epitomizes the 90s. Like, big guns and cool, just
yep.
cool-looking stuff, and who really cares about anything other than the aesthetic of it, you know?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, that's why I liked War Machine as a kid. I didn't care about James Rhodes, really, but he was cool. I liked James Rhodes, but the real reason I liked War Machine was he had one of the coolest freaking costumes in comics.
Right.
So, yeah, and here he shows up in the Iron Man costume, and he's basically, you know,
the Mark II,
confronting
I believe.
Tony about everything.
If I'm remembering the first Iron Man film correctly, I'm fairly sure that's the Mark II.
And then a drunk Tony turns around and says, "Give me a fat beat while I beat my best buddy's ass."
Yep.
Really good.
And Tony is not taking this seriously at all. And whether that's the alcohol or his own ego, or more likely a combination therein, is up to the viewer, I suppose.
Yes, I think certainly a combination probably. And they're about to tear up the boxing ring here, or the wrestling ring.
They're about to essentially destroy Tony Stark's multi-billion-dollar home, which, well, you know, I don't suppose it really matters.
No, not when you got that kind of money. And it's kind of a recurring theme in these movies. His home tends to sustain damage, I've found.
Or just fall off a cliff entirely.
Oh. This is where the movie really shines for me. This is, I think, well, I'll go ahead and get into it, because I think, you know, I am much higher on the action scenes, or not in the action scenes. I think we both like the action.
I do, yeah.
Like the quotient, I guess if we're judging films, especially superhero films, I think for me the ratio of how important the action scenes are is a little bit higher than it is for you. Is that fair to say?
That's probably true, yeah.
Yeah, so for me, I think one of the reasons that this one I like better than the first one, actually, the action scenes to me are so much better, so much more inventive, so much crisper. Their bigger budget showed, I think. But it's not just the budget, though. It's the inventiveness of the fights and just how cool they were. Part of it, admittedly, is seeing Rhodey get in on the action. Seeing War Machine later in the movie is awesome. I think the whiplash effects were really good. There is the notable anticlimactic finish to the whiplash fight at the end.
Yeah, there is.
That certainly comes out of nowhere, to the point where even when I was watching it this most recent time, when you see Whiplash, this is really cool. The first time that the repulsor beams connect, don't cross the streams, Ray.
Right, even if it is the classic comic book version of a dusty finish, you know, there cannot be a winner.
That's right. in classic hero versus hero comic book fashion.
Yes.
But in any event,
My God, they've beaten each other into submission simultaneously.
And then when they wake up, they kind of realize they want to work together, you know?
Oh, you're not so bad.
You're pretty good, too. You want to go do some stuff?
Yeah, I like to do stuff.
How are you? Better than you. They fight.
Yeah. Joe's doll looks like Joe.
And Iron Man's doll looks like Iron Man.
Yeah. Good point.
A lot of people don't know that before Dr. Nash got a hold of him, War Machine was known as Paul Nahakafakasjurkadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadigvigadig known as War Machine.
But anyway, the action scenes.
The action scenes, yeah. So the particularly that anticlimactic the Vanko fight. The most recent rewatch I did of this movie when they hit their repulsor blast together, which is a nice callback to earlier in the film, which I appreciate. I appreciate callbacks in climactic action scenes, but when they do it, it's so early in the fight with Vanko. Yeah. He's laying there, and I kept thinking, oh, he's going to wake up and attack them with another attack or something.
Nope.
And he doesn't. Nope. And it's actually a shock that he doesn't.
Right.
So I definitely agree with that. But I just think the overall quality of the action is leagues better in this one than it was in the first. And I think for me, that's the two big factors helping this one for me over the first one. And I know I'm in the minority on that. I fully appreciate that. I totally accept that. That's totally cool. But for me, the two big things that help this one are Hammer and the action scenes.
I would agree that both are very good, although I'm higher on Obadiah Stane in the first one than you are. So I probably enjoyed Hammer a little bit better, but not as much of an upgrade in my view as it probably is in yours. And the action scenes also are better, although I think the first one has some really good action scenes. The escape sequence from the cave, the assault on Golmira are both very good action scenes, and even the initial part of the Iron Man versus Ironmonger fight scene at the end are pretty good. Now here,
one brief moment. Sam, what is the line, sir? Please remove yourself from the donut.
I'm gonna have to ask you.
I'm gonna have to ask you to exit the donut.
Yeah. So my big issue with the film, and I want to, before I get into this, I want to say that, like, as we'll discuss on all of these Hard Travelers for Hire, there is not a Marvel film that's been made yet that I don't enjoy. I think they haven't made a bad movie. They've made nothing but good movies. It's just, you know, there are certain ones that you enjoy more than others. And this scene, once it concludes, kind of begins my major issue.
One second, Nick.
Yep.
Is it just me, or when Sam Jackson leans forward and said, "I'm the realest person you've ever met," do you get the impression that they filmed a version of this scene where he says, "I'm the realest motherfucker you've ever met"?
I would assume so. Oh, good Lord.
Anyway, back to your point before we get distracted again.
My point is that once this scene here at the donut shop concludes, it begins the stretch of the film that kind of is mostly responsible for my less than for my opinion of the movie being less than yours. I'll put it that way, because I think whereas the first one is almost perfectly paced and there's never really a down moment and it just kind of flows naturally from scene to scene, I think there's a 25-minute dead hole in the middle of this movie that's about to start.
You think it doesn't flow like an Iron Man movie is supposed to flow?
Yes, essentially. You know, I referenced earlier how I kind of want an Iron Man movie to hit that perfect balance, and here we get about a 20 to 25-minute stretch where it's almost entirely drama-focused, and there's not really an action scene to break it up. There's not as much humor to break it up, and it just feels kind of out of place compared to the rest of the movie, and the movie kind of grinds to a halt as a result.
It's not quite as long as you indicate. It's not 20 to 25 minutes, but I appreciate that. I mean, I will admit on the most recent rewatch, I did start nodding off a little bit when he was in the – I was kind of tired watching the movie. But I actually – I like this stretch of the movie. I know this is something that we disagreed with at the time and still do, I think. I don't love this scene as much as I did when I first saw it.
This scene is fine.
No, I'm not talking about this scene. Yeah. I'm talking about the one that you're referring to when he's at the house and he's dealing with his dad.
Well, he's at the house, he's watching the movie, and then he leaves, he goes to Pepper's, he comes back, he's looking at the whole thing. And I mean, I understand they're trying to recapture a little bit of the magic of the first movie, but watching him make an element isn't nearly as interesting as watching him make the Iron Man suit, you know?
Right, I would agree with that. And see, that element, I agree, was not very interesting. That part is kind of boring. But I liked the stuff with him seeing the message from his dad. I really liked the father-son dynamic thing here a little bit. And I also liked him coming to terms with his mortality and going to – with the intention, the full intention of telling Pepper about everything that's going on. And she just really won't hear it after the way he's been acting. And he's also so neurotic about how he's trying to say it. So I actually like this stretch of scenes. I do agree that the montage of him creating the element, probably not necessary, honestly. I think that they kind of thought that was going to be like a recurring theme in the Iron Man movies, was shots of him making stuff. And it kind of is.
Yeah.
They do it in 3, but in 3 it's I would argue it's more interestingly done than it is here. Him just making a little triangle is not not horribly interesting to see.
And realizing that the Expo is a giant model of an atom, and then he stands there like manipulating electrons and whatever else he's doing.
That's that Stark technology scene, the pulling stuff around and all that stuff. But
sure, it's just watching him pull little balls around a larger ball is not really on the same level as watching him manipulate the schematics of the original Iron Man suit from the first movie.
Well, as he said earlier in the movie, you can always count on, when it comes to pulling balls, you can always count on Tony Stark to pleasure himself.
That's true.
But the I get that for sure. But I appreciate the fact that they gave him a little bit of depth with his relationship with his dad, and he realized that his dad wasn't as completely bastardly as he thought he was.
Right, but the entire emotional journey of Tony in this movie, as you've referenced, is kind of about him coming to terms with an own mortality. And then they kind of throw the dad thing in there just kind of as a little 15-minute subplot in the middle of the movie when it hasn't really been referenced previously. And so it kind of feels just scattershot a little bit. This whole little sequence in the middle feels to me like they were like, all right, this is the character development part of the movie, and they were just kind of throwing stuff at the wall to see what stuck. And for me, not much of it, honestly.
Yeah, that's fair. It worked on me, I'll say that. It worked on me. I was a sucker for the father-son dynamic thing, and I think you're right. I think you hit upon a good point that it did feel not in line with the mortality angle, but I think one of the things that made him face his mortality is understanding that his dad, that his dad never let him know how he felt about him before he died. And that's kind of the thing that clicks with Tony, that I'm not handling my mortality the right way, because I could die tomorrow and I'll never have told Pepper how I felt about her. You know, I'll basically have died the same way my dad did in Tony's mind, which is not letting the people that he loves know how much they meant to him.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a key point. I think it's a key factor in the film, and that's why it works for me. But I get why, I get why it doesn't work for you. I get that. The other thing that we've seen in Marvel movies at times is sometimes the story that the movie is telling gets a little hamstrung by the need to connect it to the
larger cinematic. Because right now we've got Nick Fury here talking about clean energy efforts, and I'm just like, there are much more interesting usages of Nick Fury, you know?
Yeah, like telling Tony that he's the realest MF-er that he's ever met.
Exactly.
Tony has graduated to drinking water, it seems. So that's good.
No, it's probably just vodka.
Nah, you're probably right. So here's another question for you, Nick, and maybe I just missed it on this most recent rewatch. Where is this place? Like, where is this place that Nick Fury and Coulson have Tony hold up?
This is his house.
It's still his house. Okay.
Yes, he's under house arrest.
That's right. I was kind of unclear if it was some different facility they had him at or something.
No, this is his home, because remember they show him in the basement, tinkering around, doing the Iron Man stuff.
Coulson shows up very briefly in this movie,
using the Captain America shield prototype as a level of some sort.
Yeah, that Coulson only shows up briefly in this movie, but he has really good interactions with Tony.
Yep,
as usual.
And I'm pretty sure they only have him in the film just so they can make the reference about him being reassigned to New Mexico a couple of scenes.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Which is that tying it in thing that we see with the post credits scene, as you see Coulson find Mjolnir, Thor's hammer, in the middle of the desert, which I know was a big, exciting moment for all comic book fans when they were watching this in the theater.
Yeah, I knew it was coming, but it was still cool to see. And that, and, you know, we won't make it to that obviously on this watch here, but nice touch there in that post credit scene, which as the screen fades to black, you hear the roll of thunder in the background. So a cool touch by the sound editing.
Yep. The only thing that would have made it better is if Garth Brooks' "The Thunder Rolls" then played.
Somehow I knew you were going to make that reference.
Well, that's why we work so well together, Nick. Indeed. We know each other like the back and the front of our hands.
Indeed.
When the Black Widow movie going to happen?
Hopefully soon. You know, we're approaching 10 years in this role for Scarlett Johansson, and while she's still just as gorgeous as she ever was, I mean, you know, she can't do these kind of action-heavy films forever. I mean, you need to kind of strike while the iron is hot, so to speak, here.
And, that's good.
I think it's time, especially with an uncertain slate of films after Infinity War wraps up.
Yes. It's time to do one. She's earned it. I think it would be super interesting. And it's a chance to do a different kind of movie than we've seen.
More of an espionage-focused movie.
Yep. Something kind of like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. should have been, but that's...
Something kind of like the more interesting version of Ant-Man would have been.
Oh, there you go. Slagging on Ant-Man.
I'm not slagging... Again, what did I just say 5 minutes ago? They haven't made a bad movie. I'm just saying that, as we'll discuss many, many months from now,
should we both still be alive?
The flashbacks to the espionage-themed 60s Ant-Man stuff, to me, were the highlights of Ant-Man.
I thought they were good. I didn't think they were the highlights. But we'll get – that's another movie. We'll get there. this is a great scene. Sorry. I love this scene where Hammer's going through the arsenal of his weapons.
With white gloves on for some reason.
With the white gloves. As we find out later in the movie, completely bullshitting his way through this whole thing, essentially, especially when it gets to the great gag, which we'll talk about in a minute, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. You're looking at a Milcor 40mm grenade launcher, tear gas smoke, hippie control. Let me tell you something, size does matter. Don't let anyone tell you different.
There's your beloved machine gun.
Oh, love it. The shoulder cannon, yep. Boys in uniform called Uncle Gaspasso or Puff the Magic Dragon.
This is the portion of the film where Greg's just going to read the subtitles to you.
Yep, I love it. And this is the money line or the money shot. We meet the what's known as the ex-wife.
Yes, the
which is
seemingly all powerful round here.
Incendiary device busting the bunker under the bunker. A book that would make Ulysses look like it was written in crayon. It would read it to you. This is my Eiffel Tower.
As I told you, this is the portion of the podcast where Greg just reads the subtitles.
Listen, you were shitting all over the dialogue earlier. This is fantastic dialogue.
I shat on a turtle, and then I shat on the dialogue in one scene. I've praised the dialogue in the rest of the film. Thank you.
Why did he smell it?
Because he made a reference to it being the Cubans, the Cohibas, the Monte Cristos, a cigar, and that is a typical thing that cigar smokers do is you take a whiff of the cigar, a sniff, if you will, to I don't know. It's just a thing that people do.
It's just a thing you do. Yeah. Well, I remember it happening in the Bill Murray movie, The Man Who Knew Too Little. in any event, we've talked about the performances now. We've talked about the action. We've talked about the divide in kind of our take on it. And we've talked about the lull in the film, which is still going on here in this scene here where he's kind of actually, Kyle Dory is kind of beginning here where he's starting to go through his stuff. But although I like the stuff with Howard, and you see that Howard, he does care about Tony, even though he kind of, you know, I would argue it still doesn't excuse him, you know, treating Tony like crap. But it was a different era, I suppose.
Yes. So we have to have we have Tony watching home movie time here, so that's
which is reminiscent actually of Christmas Vacation when Chevy goes upstairs and he watches the old home movies and reminisces about Christmas before falling through the ceiling.
Yes. Sadly there's no comedic beat of anyone falling through a ceiling here.
I don't know what your problem is with this.
It's not a huge problem. It's just that the film kind of has been well paced and kind of moving along, and here it kind of grinds to a halt. Like you said yourself, you nodded off earlier. I've probably seen the film 3 or 4 times in theaters at this point. A couple times during marathon sessions. And this is always the point where I'm like, all right, if I'm going to make it through this marathon, I got to take a nap at some point. And I'm always like, well, let me just get comfortable here and wait until this part of Iron Man 2 is
that,
over.
That looked like an homage to Anchorman, by the way. Scotchy, scotch, scotch, scotch.
Yeah, a little bit. A little bit.
But yeah, so, you know, we've talked a little bit about pretty much all these aspects of the film. But coming down the home stretch, we're about to hit, after they get through this, we get kind of the big action set piece of Tony running away from the multiple drones. And
it isn't even really the best action set piece in the movie, in my opinion.
No.
I think
no, it isn't, but it's a good one.
The race scene is better. I think the Iron Man versus War Machine fight in the middle of it is better. And that's one another reason why
Black Widow infiltration.
Yeah, the Black Widow infiltration scene. That's another reason that kind of colors my perception of it is the closing climactic scene is somewhat anticlimactic.
That's certainly fair to say. I would argue that's the case for the bulk of the Marvel movies.
Right, which is an issue. I mean, that is
until Avengers, yeah.
Right.
Because we'll talk about Thor here next month, I believe, and Thor suffers from the same issue. The destroyer fight's not.
The destroyer fight isn't great, but the Rainbow Bridge fight, as short as it is, carries an emotional weight that resonates with me.
There's Tony breaking the speed limit again, most likely
buying strawberries.
Okay, Mr. Hardy.
But yeah, so you have the somewhat anticlimactic final scene. And from there, you have a kind of good little callback with Gary Shandling, Senator Stern, presenting...
Great moment, yeah.
Presenting medals of heroism to Tony and Colonel Rhodes and stuff. So, and that's kind of where the movie wraps up before you flow into the post-credit scene that we referenced earlier. So that's kind of Iron Man 2 in a nutshell.
And a lot of great lines, one-liners from Tony along the way, especially as he's screwing around with Black Widow, who's still trying to maintain her cover at Stark Industries. And then, of course, she turns into ultra badass to go after Vanko. Overall impressions of the film. Anything else that we have to add that we haven't already mentioned?
No, I think we've pretty well discussed it. You know, we both... I mean, it's clear at this point to anyone who's listening that we both enjoyed it. You enjoyed it more than I did, and we've kind of given our reasons for our divide enjoyment of it.
What is this thing, real quick? What is this metal thing? Because it drives me nuts too. It drives Tony nuts.
It's a statue. It's a piece of art.
It's a piece of art that won't stop turning.
Yes, it's the
perpetually
perpetual motion art.
Yes, you know? Tony doesn't like it either.
No, he doesn't.
Anyway, so as we've done with all of these, we've mentioned they have made a bad one, liked all of them so far. But I think we're getting to that point now where we're actually going to have usable rankings.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct on this? So based on our most recent rewatches, how would you rank them so far?
I am going – clearly, clear cut, Iron Man, the original, is number one. And then this is where it gets tough, because every time I rewatch them, especially in sequence, it seems like it changes between this one and Incredible Hulk. On our most recent rewatches, I'm going to go this one at 2 and Incredible Hulk at 3, but the margin between those for me is razor thin. Enjoy both. Don't enjoy either nearly as much as I do the first Iron Man. But on this most subsequent rewatch, I'd give the slightest of edges, I guess, to this over Hulk. So I'm going Iron Man, Iron Man 2, Incredible Hulk.
I am going to go Iron Man 2, I know controversially, Iron Man 2, Iron Man, and Incredible Hulk. And Iron Man and Iron Man 2 are close and competitive with one another. I have them well ahead of the Hulk, even though I like the Hulk, the Incredible Hulk, I should say. Mm-hmm. Ang Lee's Hulk would be on a different list. But no, so that's my ranking. So there you have it, folks. The third iteration of Hard Travelers for Hire. I think our rankings are going to be more interesting as the series goes on and we add more to them. I'm actually intrigued by how this is going to go because I'm interested in how my opinions are going to change based on rewatches. What about you, Nick?
I'm somewhat interested in that, especially on films that I've been conflicted on in the past. I know, for example, Captain America: The First Avenger is one that my opinion started out as one thing and has kind of gradually shifted over time. So I'm interested to see if it continues to shift on our upcoming rewatch. Thor: The Dark World will be another. Various ones that I'm interested in rewatching. And then, of course, eventually we will reach Iron Man 3, which I think is going to be the most contentious of all our debates, probably. Because I think our divide on how much we enjoy that one is probably even larger than our divide on this one. I don't think there's any doubt it's larger than it is on this one.
Yeah, and that'll be very curious. It's also going to be curious to see how well Age of Ultron holds up on rewatch.
I have rewatched Age of Ultron twice probably in the last year. And for me, again, it's not... We'll get there, but I will say that the two rewatches I have done treated it very well, in my opinion.
Yeah. It's also you also have a bit of a leg up on me in this because I haven't seen these movies nearly as many times as you have because you've seen them on marathons a few times and also watched them on home video. Some of these I've seen more than others. The Phase 1 movies I've seen a lot.
Yep.
The Phase 2 movies
I
have not seen.
The Phase 1 movies I've seen a ton. The Phase 2 movies, I've seen Winter Soldier a lot, and I've seen Guardians a couple times, or several times. I've seen Iron Man 3 probably two or three times. I've seen Dark World probably the same, and I've seen, so a couple times for some of the Phase 2 movies, but the Phase 1s I've seen, ad nauseum at this point.
You mentioned Dark World, and for one of our upcoming shows, we're actually going to be joined by the Dark Passenger, Tim Capel, so.
Yes, he is going to be our official Captain America correspondent as we make our way through the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So the first of several Tim Capel guest appearances will be coming up whenever we reach Captain America: The First Avenger.
Right. And next month, we're actually going to be joined by our good buddy, the editor of this very podcast, Todd Weber.
That is the goal, if we can work out the schedules.
If we can lock him down, he's a busy man.
If we can get him away from the set of Crocodile Dundee 4, Paul Hogan will be here, ladies and gentlemen.
That's right. That's right. Paul Hogan will be joining us alongside Todd Weber, hopefully, if we can get Todd for Thor, the original Thor movie, to join us and talk about that one. What do we have on deck going into the Christmas season here, Nick?
Well, coming up to close out the year, we, of course, have another edition of The Long Book Hunters coming up. To tie in with the upcoming release of Star Wars Rogue One, in which will feature the return of Darth Vader to the big screen, we're going to be taking a look at Darth Vader's very own solo comic series using the wonderful Webby Award-winning Marvel Unlimited app. This will be Greg's first exposure to the series. It's something that I've been highly recommended to him for quite some time, so I think be interested to get his take on how that series holds up to a more casual Star Wars fan than I. And then, of course, for the next show, I believe we've got a countdown coming up, which is going to be one of our most challenging countdowns of all time, as we are going to attempt to rank our top five Geoff Johns Green Lantern issues of all time.
Oof.
Gonna be tough. Gonna be, like choosing your favorite kids there. And then, of course, at the end of the month, we are hitting you with a giant size edition as we wrap up 2016 with a year in review show, on which we will be joined by the likes of Russell Sellers, Jennifer Smith, and hopefully Todd Weber as well. So got all that coming for you up here in the month of December. And then as we start the new year, we'll have a little bit of a schedule change. Nothing moving off the schedule or onto the schedule, just we're going to be shifting around a little bit so that we won't be doing movie watches 2 weeks in a row. We're going to kind of try to get away from that pattern.
Yes, and so all of that can be enjoyed here at Place to Be Nation Pop every week. And, of course, we also invite you to listen to all the great content here at Place to Be Nation Pop. Seller's Points, which is having me as a guest in the very near, just recently, actually. It could be up by the time you're hearing this podcast. I'm not sure. But we did a Guide to Superman edition with me and Russell and Kelly. Really good episode of labor of love. It's very long, very, very long, but it was a labor of love for all of us who love that character so much. So that be on the lookout for that. Geek and Sassy continues to kill it. Check their shows out every couple weeks here at Place to Be Nation Pop. Todd Weber is back in the game, folks, with a great conversation with the Dark Passenger, Tim Capel, as they discuss Chris Claremont and John Byrne's legendary X-Men run. Great stuff here, and it's actually created the spark for what could lead to another podcast coming soon about Marvel and DC trading cards. So be maybe on the lookout for that in the new year. We'll see. And of course, all the other content, Lucha Undead, Imaginary Stories, just a cornucopia of comic book and pop culture content. And, of course, all the great sports content as well. Andrew Reich killing it with his NBA stuff. Just listen to all that stuff. And if you're a wrestling fan, I mean, Lord, I mean, you're not hurting for great content there. So check all that stuff out. Join us next week. Should be a fun edition as we get to talk about Star Wars, and maybe we'll get into a little bit of the finales, of course, of the CW shows and the mid-season finale of The Walking Dead. So be on the lookout for all of that next week. And in the meantime, I have a bit of a reading recommendation for all of you. It's a book that I've been reading lately, a real book, not a comic book, a real book, a book with no pictures in it. It's nonfiction, it's informative, and it's making some pretty big headway in my life. And of course, Nick, I'm referring to The Vet Method.
So, The Vet Method will, of course, change your life and the way you look at things, so be sure to check that out.
Yep. In the meantime, go read some comics, folks, and come to us on the Facebook Place to Be Nation comics page. Comment, leave your thoughts on this movie, leave your thoughts on our rankings thus far, and also tweet us at NickDuke87, at GPhillips8652. And until next week, we hope you have a great time and roll tide. I am Iron Man.